Good evening, everybody. Mike DePalma alongside my co-host Danny Santarella. Got Neil Lynch joining us from the Hoboken studio. We are the Tri-State Sports Guys, number one sports podcast in all of Connecticut. Talking a lot of hockey tonight. Let me bring my boy Neil on there. You might recognize Neil Lynch from our website today. Found a great Neil Lynch photo from college. Neil, did you check that photo out, buddy?
I have not seen it yet, no.
Oh, go to our website while we're talking here, and I got a good one. It looks like you're about to break off a nasty circle change. Now, we're going to do a lot of hockey talk, Danny, but I want to start out with some Cubbies talk. Can we talk some Cubbies?
Okay.
Maybe you know where I'm going with this. Have you seen who's their new player coach at the AAA Iowa?
I actually have.
The Mr. One and only, Neil, did you see this? Mr. Manny Ramirez? Is the player coach at AAA Iowa?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it lends itself to the belief that Manny Ramirez is not human.
He may not be a human being, but I think, let me ask you this, Dan, because we've actually do a lot of Cubby talk here, and hopefully I'm trying to get Maddie to get Ernie Banks to call in a little later on. Is it Maddie, if we could just get that to happen, just to give his 2 cents, good friend of the show, Ernie. But, you know, the Cubs have been building up this farm system, and we talked about it. And they've got a lot of guys sitting down there on the right in the wing, Chris Bryant, Javier Baez, the two guys that everybody knows. But they've also got, you know, Mike Holt at the big league level now and Junior Lake and obviously starting cash. So they got this young nucleus they're trying to build. And so Epstein decides the guy he wants to be the final step before you get to the big leagues is Manny Ramirez. And it sounds on the surface to be complete insanity. But people want to talk about this guy being out there and crazy. This guy was a smart player. This guy was not just a God's gift to hitting. I mean, this guy worked his ass off in the cage, according to everybody, and would outthink a pitcher, would take the ball the other way as good as anybody. I don't think it's as ludicrous as people think. I mean, when you saw it on the surface, I don't think it's a publicity ploy because this guy's not popular anymore. If people hate him, he's hated around all of baseball. So, Danny, I want to get your thoughts on it. Give me 2 minutes on it.
Well, I wasn't overly thrilled when I saw it. And I actually said to a buddy of mine who sent me the text informing me that it happened the day it happened. And I just said, I go, you know, dude, just when you think it can't get worse, being a Cubs fan, they go for this, like, circus-like ploy.
But
huh?
You think it's a circus
well,
ploy?
I agree
you
with you.
Tickets for AAA Iowa?
I agree with you with all this stuff. Well, they sell well anyway. They're one of the top grossing teams in the PCL. So they sell tickets in Iowa, probably because there's not a lot to do in Iowa. But they sell tickets there. And you know what? The funny thing to me was a week or two ago on a Cubs blog that I was reading, it was, what are they going to do with Baez and Castro? How's that going to work out? What's going to happen there? When's Chris Bryant going to be ready? Michael, fat 170, but he hits bombs and he does all these things. Samardzija, Jackson, Wood, what's going on with those guys? And so, you know, you watch them over the weekend in San Fran, and before that they were down in San Diego. You know what? There were some signs of promise. Like, there were some things I liked watching those late 10 o'clock games. Then you wake up one day, you get a text from a buddy that Manny Ramirez is now the key to the minor league, the betterment of the minor league system down there in Iowa. So one of the arguments I heard from one of the Chicago papers, who they have, the Herald and the Sun or something like
yeah.
that, was there's a lot of Spanish-speaking players in Iowa. So you bring this guy in, and he can kind of tutor those guys and bring them along. And everything you said is true from what you hear.
But that's why they got Rich Renteria. I think first name, Rick?
Rich
Renteria.
Yeah. Well, he's just a genius, isn't he? I can't even look at him, but that's a totally different story. So if they're saying that, like, they want to bring in a guy who's a Spanish-speaking guy, he is, you know, I'm not a guy who gets on the bandwagon for the steroid-type players, but okay, these young guys are going to look up there. But then I'm waiting for the punchline. Now, Neil's a stand-up comic. Maybe Neil knows what the punchline is, and I'm going, okay, you bring in Manny. What are you planning on doing? You're going to pinch hit him? Like, he's going to pinch it, maybe play a little outfield, DH, or do something like I don't get what the reason is for it because, like I said, they already sell well. So you're not running. You ever watch that Pecos League thing on Fox Sports 1?
Never caught that.
You got to catch that because I think you like it. It's actually some funny stuff. They try to come up with, like, weird ways to sell tickets.
Yeah, yeah.
Because literally 30, 40 people go to the games. It's like below independent league ball.
Yeah.
Manny Ramirez would make sense in the Pecos league.
Yeah.
He doesn't make sense in the PCL.
That's why I don't think it's a ploy. I'll turn it over to Neil after this, but that's why I don't think it's a ploy to sell tickets or to get some publicity because it would sell tickets, like you said. You know, the Bridgeport Bluefish want to sign Manny Ramirez, it would clearly sell tickets. Long Island Ducks or, like, some really struggling minor league team. But I don't think they're doing it for that. I think that, and I don't think the Spanish-speaking thing makes any sense either, because there's a million guys that could speak Spanish. Look at Joey Porra to coach third base, you know, coach the AAA team. I honestly think there's a part of Epstein that thinks, you know, this guy made it at the highest level, and not only made it, like just said, outwardly successful at every level. You got these guys that want to learn from somebody who's gotten it done at the big league level. This is how you play at the big league level, even though guys out of his mind.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
And then we'll get Neil's take on it. Why didn't he even interview Ryan Sandberg? That was one of the things that crossed my mind. Like, you just let him go to Philly. Yeah. He's the most legendary Latter-day Cub.
Yeah.
They didn't even give him an interview. So if you want to bring in somebody who's shown the right way to do things, Sandberg played the game the right way. He's in the Hall of Fame. I mean, I don't know what else they wanted him to do in Chicago. Yeah. He never won a damn thing, like every other Cub. But you could have hired him.
Yeah.
At the big league level, and maybe Castro would get the message that Jimmy Rollins got in Philly, which is not putting up with this. I'm not putting up with loafing and idiotic stuff. You're either going to play because, you know, I'm better than you anyway. So, so they could have done that, but then they went the Manny Ramirez route. So you just wonder, like, did Epstein owe him a favor? From Boston?
That's his best friend.
Like, what is going on?
That's his boy. Now, Neil, what is your take on it? Outlandish or what?
I mean, you know, it on the surface, it seems like they're grasping for straws, but at the same time, I mean, no one's arguing with the guy's credentials. I cannot see him as a coach that is able to communicate and relate to players. But, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, when you say Manny Ramirez, do you think, like, great teammate? You know, would make a coach someday. It just doesn't seem to pop to my mind right away. So, I mean, but he could prove us all wrong. You know, I think that it is weird that they would go to Manny and not, someone that's a little bit closer to the ball club. But, I think you have to give it some time before you immediately pan it. I mean, I'm not immediately panning it. I think there's an outside shot that it could pan out.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, we're talking about AAA coach. How many AAA coaches do you know? We know Wally Backman here in the New York area because he won the post. But are they making it? You know, just clearly they knew when they made this signing here and this hiring, it was going to make a splash. There's no way around it. You hire Manny Ramirez. You know, I don't know.
Well, to me, like I said, watching the West Coast trip, watching some of the things the Cubs did. Everybody knows the Cubs aren't good. Everybody knows the farm system is loaded and they're trying to build for 2015, 16, 17. Okay. What you saw on that West Coast trip was a lot of good stuff. Saw some good starts, saw some good swings from Sheerholt, his first homer. I mean, you had things that you could look forward to as a Cubs fan, and then this. And it's strange to me because there was some good things happening that for a Cubs fan who we don't have anything to really look forward to, you're going, hey, you know what? I mean, Darwin Barney got a sacrifice bunt down. It was great because he can't hit anything. You know what I mean? So there was some positive stuff. And then all of a sudden I got to hear about Manny Ramirez, you know, being hired as a player coach in Iowa. And I just can't wait to see. You think at the end of the day, Epstein thinks Manny's going to be on the big club?
That was the last thing I wanted to ask you. What if he goes down there and hits 400 and the surprise balls are flying out of the yard down there? Is that a possibility? Is that part of what – they're thinking possibility. I mean, how does that make sense of the long-term plan, though? With the Chicago Cubs,
you got
guys that you're trying to find time for in the outfield. You know, Junior Lake is a guy that you've been hyping, and he's not playing every day because they got to get Justin Ruggieri or whatever his name is.
Ruggiano. I don't know. I mean, they sent down Kalish when Ruggiano got healthy, so you do have. I like Ruggiano and I like Kalish, but you have guys that you can send down if you wanted to call somebody big up. The problem I have is Renteria and Swain Forum. They're trying to get a head on the shoulders of guys like Leake and Castro. They do some dumb things, some boneheaded stuff. They're trying to get some things going the right way. They had an issue with Castillo a few weeks ago, not running out of ball and doing things. So you know you have some problems calling up Manny. Isn't exactly like calling up some legendary player who really hustled and did everything the right way.
Yeah.
So they're complaining about getting the young guys to do things the right way. You have three Spanish-speaking players there. I don't know if that's the sell-off. Like, the trade-off, rather, like get Manny up here to get these guys' heads right, because you still have the Manny being Manny stuff that he did in Boston and L.A. So what I don't understand it.
Maybe it's the reformed guy. Apparently, he's found God in the last year and a half.
Who hasn't?
Neil may have. I don't know. So, maybe it is. It's like do as I say, not as I did. As a player, and here's my mistake. I took a Hall of Fame career and I threw it down the toilet. Don't look at me with what I did, all the negatives, and I could actually teach you how to do something. And maybe that's part of what, like, Mark McGwire is doing as a hitting coach. Who would have thought he would have been a hitting coach? If you think of, like, traditional hitters, I would not think of Mark McGwire as being a guy who knows how to hit.
He had, like, 80 hits in his career.
Yeah, he's
got 500-some homers, he's got 600 hits.
Yeah. All right. Well, we promised the listeners hockey talk, so why don't we transition over to hockey? I'm going to just, just turn it over to you. But watching the game last night as I did, as I said, I didn't want to tweet from our account because I didn't want to seem like one of those guys that knows what he's talking about. But, as a casual fan, the one thing everybody always marks on is Lundqvist's playoff record. It's a 500 playoff goalie, and this man, he's been great during this run they've made. But with, the Stanley Cup right at their fingertips going to the finals, they give them four goals early. What do you make of that? Is there anything to that?
Well, like I said to you before the show, I had a softball game last night. I did have the game taping. I have seen the game, Sam's commercial. So, to me, it's a situation. The legendary Hall of Fame coach, Scotty Bowman, once said, you get an elite goalie on his game playing properly, and you need three goals to win.
Yeah.
And Lundqvist certainly qualifies in that group of elite modern goaltenders. I think what you saw watching it was some meltdowns, some breakdowns with some different coverages and some things that were going on. I think it was a great move putting in Talbot. You send a message. Clearly, Vigneault's not saying Lundqvist isn't good.
Yeah.
He's basically saying you guys are playing so awful in front of him that even he can't save anything. So they put in Talbot. They go on a little three-goal run there. They tie it up at four. The third period got away from them a little bit. The thing that struck me throughout the whole series, and I've actually said it to a couple of Ranger fan friends of mine, is you got Montreal playing their big four on defense, like around 52 minutes a night. I mean, Weaver and Beaulieu get in there for 8-9 minutes, which is hardly anything. Usually your third pairing will get 14 minutes. And the Rangers just have this refusal. Even when they had the 3-1 lead, I still looked at every game and I was going, something's going to give. They're not getting the pucks in behind those big four defenders. You talk about Subban, talk about Markov, talk about Yemelin and Georges. You've got to make those guys work, because if they're going to play them 25 minutes plus each, you have to make life difficult on them. And the Rangers just don't have that guy, that Milan Lucic-type, Dustin Brown-type player that'll go in there and bang and do all the things they want. No, they played really well, and you're getting great play from Saint-Louis and Zuccarello and Hagelin, and then Richards and Nash are starting to pick it up. I just wonder if that's eventually going to come back to haunt them, that Montreal's coach, Michel Therrien, thinks, I can play these big four all I want, because they're not going to bang us. They're not going to get in there and hit us and make us work 200 feet to get the puck down the ice. And you saw a really fresh Montreal team last night, and a Rangers team that looked maybe a little bit tired, other than that little 7-8 minute run they had in the second period. And I just wonder if that's going to come back to haunt them, because you want to bang all seven games or whatever it's going to be in the playoff series, and you haven't seen the Rangers do it.
Yeah.
So you have now four extremely talented defensive to Montreal that haven't really been pushed. Sikarski's playing well enough to keep their head above water. And you got a lot of frontline speed, and now the Rangers last night, they looked slow for the first time in the series.
Yeah,
I mean, you watch the game, and like I said, other than 6, 7, 8 minutes in the second period where they went on a little three-goal barrage, they looked tired. I don't want to say lazy, but they didn't look lazy. They just looked, like, exhausted, and their shifts were short. They were 35-second shifts instead of 45, 50 in the second period. It was odd.
Yeah.
So, I mean, tomorrow now goes without saying, but it's the biggest game in Madison Square Garden in 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's a must-win, because you go back to Montreal, and you get that ceremony for the game, lighting ice on fire and doing all the stuff they do up there, that place is going to be a nut house. And I think the Rangers now, tomorrow, even though they're home, the pressure is squarely on their shoulders.
Yeah.
Because even though they're up 3-2, they played a pretty ugly game last night for 52 minutes.
Yeah.
And now you wonder if their chickens are going to come home to roost now, because they had their opportunities to really bang these guys and they didn't.
Yeah. Now, Neil, I want to ask you, I don't know how much of the game you caught, but, you know, all Rangers fans are kind of in panic mode a little bit now because now they kind of see it's a must-win game and you don't want to go to game seven. But take a step back and look at it. They weren't really supposed to win last night in Montreal. They're in Montreal. Vegas had Montreal as a favorite. You know, it's not like, you know, it wasn't a huge favorite. I think they were -120. It was a huge favorite. They were the favorite. You know, they had breakdowns on defense, like Danny said, but, you know, they were able to put up four goals. It's not like they were just lackadaisical there. I mean, is there a little bit too much panic, Neil, on the Rangers side, fan-wise?
Well, I don't know if it's panic per se or as much as it is urgency in realizing what opportunity lies ahead of you. I mean, you know, the fact that they lost in the fashion that they did last night, you know, in getting, you know, they had the game within the grasp, they tied it up, and then they just unraveled, you know, after that. Game six is imperative. I really do think, you know, a lot of Ranger fans realize that the odds of them going up to Montreal and winning game seven are pretty slim. So, you know, it's a must-win game, game six. And, you know, because I don't know what happens if it goes to game seven. I mean, do you really want to put Lundqvist out there again after what happened, knowing his history up there, even though he had a spectacular game two? You know, are you going to risk it with Talbot in the net? I just, there's so many question marks going back up there that you really want to nail it down, you know, in the next game.
Well, I don't think there's any question. I'm not sure if that's what you're saying, but I don't think there's any question Lundqvist is playing tomorrow and starting, and he'll be playing going forward however far they get. I just really do think that it's a positive message Vigneault sending to his team, which is, you know, You can't even help arguably or possibly the best goaltender in the world. That's how loose you're playing. That's how soft you're being on the puck like they were last night in Montreal. And it sends that message. Now, Talbot didn't play particularly well, but again, the Rangers really didn't improve any on defense the minute he went in the game. So I'm sitting there last night watching that game on tape, and I'm going, you know, I know the outcome, but you're looking for something to hang your hat on. If you're looking for something to hang your hat on as a Rangers fan, I don't think you ever found it. And it just seemed, if you saw how many turnovers there were, you know, in the neutral zone, the Rangers were gaining the red line and not getting it in. It's just a lot of mishaps on the Rangers' end. And for a team now, and a lot of people will say that one of the worst leads you can have in hockey is a 3-1 series lead. And now you're looking at it like you're up 3-2, but the Rangers fans are acting like they're down 8-1. Like, it's unbelievable to me. I don't think it's quite that much panic, but I think the first thing you'll look for tomorrow night, or that I'll be looking for as I'm watching, and I know people that watch a lot of hockey, you're probably saying the same thing, especially Rangers fans. You have to get the puck in on these guys and make them work. You have to make Therrien not put his top guys out there. If you get Weaver and Beaulieu out there through the Rangers and get them playing 14, 15 minutes because they have to extend their shifts, you give yourself an extra 5 minutes without those big four on the ice. It's essentially like having a 5-minute major power play. Like, you're playing against fifth and sixth defensemen that Weaver and Beaulieu probably wouldn't be on the ice for any of the three other teams in these playoffs. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
The other three teams all go deep. They all roll their 6D men. Now the Rangers don't have John Moore. He's out with some undisclosed lower body injury or something like that, I think it was. So now
he got suspended.
Did he get suspended?
Yeah, he got suspended 2 games for the check on a Weiss, or Weiss, whatever the hell his name is.
What is it? For a check on Weiss, Weiss?
There was a check to the head. I mean, they had exchanged hits before that. Some pretty brutal checks, and then I guess, Weiss was coming around mid-ice towards the blue line, and then, you know, he passed the puck, and then I guess Moore went a little high and hit him in the head. And if you look at Weiss, after the hit, he looks really dazed. His helmet comes off, and he's just kind of like, he looks lost. So, it came down, I guess, today that Moore suspended for 2 games. So, you know, one of the more physical guys I guess the Rangers have now is gone. So you wonder, like, how physical can they be in game six and in seven? I kind of agree with you. You know, you have to look at what has been the formula of success for the Rangers, and that's just, you know, just get shots on goal. I mean, it seems like a lot of the games that they've lost this year, in the playoffs. They can't crack 20 shots total. And it's just, you know, you can't win that way.
Yeah, you know, Neil, as a, like I said, as a guy who's not watched a ton of Rangers, but seen a decent amount of it just for the show and for Danny's sake here, you know, one of the critiques I've had of the Rangers is exactly that throughout the season. It just seems like the puck is always in the other team's ice, and you feel like they're not getting enough shots on goal, and it's almost like they're looking for the perfect shot. But it seems like it has shifted in the playoffs here, and you've seen this resurgence of Marty St. Louis. And so, again, I want to ask you, you know, when the trade went down, we broke it down, and you weren't a fan of it, per se, and I asked you point blank, does this make give them a better chance to win the Stanley Cup? Now, seeing what you've seen from St. Louis this playoff, have you changed your tune a little bit on that? Do you think that that is exactly what they needed?
Well, just to be clear, what I said about the trade was I didn't like to trade what they gave up. I mean, you give up Callahan, who's a solid player. You give up a top draft pick to get Marty St. Louis, which is essentially a two-year rental. I mean, any trade that leads to you winning the Stanley Cup is going to be a good one.
100%.
So, I mean, people tried to kill Pocklington and Edmonton when he traded Gretzky. Well, they won a Stanley Cup 3 years later.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that turns out to be – and they won it with the parts he got in the Gretzky deal with L.A. So, you know, you trade the greatest player that ever played and you win a Stanley Cup, you win. I mean, that's
yeah.
St. Louis is the better player.
Right.
And I think Sather was put into a position where he has a winger who's not a goal-scoring winger who's asking for $6.5 million. Now, at the center position, like Getzloff or Taves, guys like that, you can get $7 million a year and be a solid two-way player. It's an important, it's a more important position. Callahan asking for $6.5 million when he's never had a 35-40 goal season is ridiculous. And I think Sather finally said, you know what, I've had enough.
Yeah.
How much do you want to push when you know you're not worth $6.5 million, but you're going to try to leverage me because you're wearing the C on your chest.
And the fans love him.
You're a career Ranger and the fans love him. But more important than me, because, like I said, St. Louis is the better player. I said it at the time. I just don't know if the trade's going to be worth it in the long run.
Yeah.
And if they don't win the Stanley Cup this year, 2 years from now, after St. Louis' contract is up, that's exactly what Ranger fans are going to be looking for when they look for those top draft picks, and they don't have them.
Yeah, that was the question posed at the time was, does St. Louis put them over the top? Clearly, it was a win-now move. Does that put them over the top to make them a Stanley Cup contender? You know, where they're sitting right now, like you mentioned, they're still 3-2, up 3-2, at home, in position to move on to the Stanley Cup. I'm not saying, you know, we had the same discussion that we're having now is the discussion we had, you know, a couple months ago. But the question is, do you think that he's made them more of a Stanley Cup team than you had anticipated? Because the question was, does St. Louis give them a shot to win the Cup? And, I, you know, at the time, you were like, I don't think so. I don't think that because they ended Marty St. Louis, they're going to go out and hoist the trophy. Does that now change a little bit? Are you seeing it now? This is more of an overall playoff question than we were looking at, like, you know, last night or in the last couple games. But do you think now that maybe that does justify it? Because, like you said, if it's a cup now or a cup 3 years from now, you know, Rangers fans want a cup.
Right. Well, I mean, is he doing more than I thought he'd be doing?
Yeah, he's playoff wise. Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing more than I thought he'd be doing. But I still think that the best players the Rangers have had on the ice up front have been Hagelin and Zuccarello, and I think it's been that way since the Philly series. Those two have been solid throughout. Richards, people like to kill on Richards when he doesn't score. You know, he has an empty score sheet. The guy wins faceoffs. The guy's pretty good, you know, in the two-way game. He's pretty good through the neutral zone. He makes good decisions. They've had a lot of guys contribute. What you're getting from St. Louis now, and I said it when he scored the winner in game four, was Callahan could stand there with a bucket of pucks and never score them. You know what I mean? And that's what you're getting there is, he's on the right wing. He scored that puck on the right side of the ice, right where Callahan would have been playing.
Yeah.
Callahan's not scoring it. I don't think I ever saw Callahan score a short side goal in my life watching him play. That goal alone, a game winner in OT of the playoffs, and at the end of the day, when you made that trade, as the New York Rangers did, if someone told you you're going to be up 3-2 in the conference finals with a home game coming up, you would have signed up for it then. But I don't think
St. Louis is called a genius on the spot.
Right. I don't think St. Louis is the reason. He's been better than I thought he would be. I don't think he's the reason they're here.
That's basically maybe the question I'm getting at. Is the impact of St. Louis the reason they're here?
No. But he's better. I thought you were going to say, you know.
Yeah, would they be here without him? No.
That's tough to say, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we will never know, but I don't think so. But I think Lundqvist has been outstanding. I think McDonough has been good, even though he's much maligned. He's playing hurt, and it's clear he doesn't have the same jump in his step that he had. even in the Olympics. Like, you know, so just 4 or 5 months ago, he was skating a lot faster and a lot better. You have Girardi and Stahl both playing pretty solidly in the defensive end. So you got a lot of parts that are working. And, you know, the other thing that I've talked with a couple of people about is I think with the struggling power play, I mean, it's almost time now that you take Brad Richards off the point. It's never made sense. I talked to our buddy Rich from Huntington who said, you know, I've been saying this for 2 years and I've agreed with him. You have a guy on the point on your power play and it's killing the Rangers.
Yeah.
And you're hearing Rangers fans say that same thing and guys are writing about it in the papers. Like, what is Brad Richards doing on the point? You had John Moore who's got a bomb. You got Stroman who hits BDs from the point. And they keep putting Brad Richards out there, and then you've seen a couple breakdowns in their power play, the puck heads the other way, and those forwards don't defend backskating like a defenseman would.
Yeah.
So, it to me, it's like those little things the Rangers are doing. That if they lose this series, because everybody's high on the Rangers, and rightfully so, if they lose the series, those are the things that people that really follow hockey are going to be going, here's all the things the Rangers could have done differently. And it'll be interesting, because I don't see Vigneault taking him off the point. I don't see him making wholesale changes like that. But there are a couple things that got to concern you tomorrow night, even though you're at the Garden, even though you're home.
Yeah.
You know Montreal is going to be playing like their hair is on fire.
Yeah.
And they're going to come in and ride that crowd like they, you know, like they have done on the road throughout the playoffs. So you're going to have your hands full tomorrow, no matter what you want to say right now, San Luis or no San Luis, the Rangers are going to be in trouble tomorrow if they don't play better and smarter than they've done in a couple games this season.
Seems sloppy.
Yeah, it seems very sloppy.
All right, well, if you want to call some hockey, number to call is always 347-637-2306. We're going to go out to the phones now. We're going to have the line number one and a good friend of the show, Mr. Cowboy and Norwell. Cowboy.
How you guys doing?
How we doing? You want to talk some Rangers or what, brother?
Of course I want to talk some Rangers, man.
What's going on down at the pub? Now, Cowboy works at one of our sponsors, O'Neill's Pub down in South Norwalk. So, I mean, what's the feeling down there? Nuts or what? I mean, people are going to be going nuts tomorrow night?
People will be going nuts tomorrow night, but I'll tell you the feeling is that the Rangers, Ranger fans always kind of feel like the series isn't over till it's over. And that, I feel like that about any way with hockey, but especially towards Ranger fans. Before 94, it was 40 years since they won it, and now it's like 20 years you're in a situation. So they always feel like the odds are against them. Where, you know, it's never over until the last puck and then the time hits zero. I mean, if you look back at other years where they had close, they had to, the Devils, I thought, beat 3 years ago, and then the Devils come back, Marty Boris sitting on top of his head, and the Rangers don't go. And that's just how it is. You know, the Ranger fans always think the worst is going to happen to them. So last night was not a good showing for the Rangers, so. That's where all the panic sets in a little bit because you say, man, if they come out like they did last night, there's no way we're winning this series.
Cowboy, what do you think is the biggest concern from what you're hearing from people that are Rangers fans? I mean, is it the ineptitude on the power play? Is it maybe some of the soft play in the defensive zone? What's the stuff you're hearing, or is it just a general, like, drunken nervousness that people are experiencing down there?
In the beginning, it was the power play, but then, believe it or not, I mean, you've seen it. The power play has actually picked up lately. But now when you see the physicality of the game, especially, the Moore hit, which, you know, a lot of people were disgusted by the hit, and the stupid penalties more than anything. Like, to start off the game to go on when you're man down is not a way to start off a game. Then you're chasing and trying to, you know, play catch-up throughout the whole game rather than, you know, dumping the puck in and killing the clock, and they're trying to play catch up, trying to take a chance here and there. But when they tied it up last night, I thought the game, I was like, the Rangers are going to come back and it's over. That's it. You know, they're so fired up right now. But, you know, alluding to what you said before, you saw them slow down big time, which you never seen in the playoffs. And probably, you know, at all, this is the slowest I've probably seen them throughout the whole entire playoffs was last night. Which kind of concerns me in a sense, but, you know, you're coming back to your home ice. You got, you know, the better goalie, so you still got to feel good about yourself. I mean, I don't think it's time to panic, but I think, you should be worried. I think at any time, you see it more in hockey than any other sport. Like, if a baseball, you know, you're playing baseball, you're facing, you know, Adam Wainwright. You're like, man, he's going to mow us down tonight. But then tomorrow night's a different story. You're not facing Adam Wainwright. You're facing somebody totally different. In hockey, you got the same guy grinding it out you know, going towards the net. You know, it's all, you know, it's all about, you know, who's hot, who's not. You know, the Rangers were hot, and last night they were not. And you see, you know, a little something like that last night could, you know, propel Montreal to go to the Stanley Cup and win the whole thing.
Yeah, you know, I think in hockey, I think momentum is the bigger in hockey than any other sport. And I do think momentum exists in all sports. But even football, which you're playing a different opponent every week in the playoffs, I do really believe in momentum. And that's why I hate the teams that sit all their guys in week 16 and to get ready and healthy for the playoffs. I don't think that works out. But, you know, you can just look at this playoffs and just look at San Jose. You know, talk about momentum. And all of a sudden, the pressure starts mounting on the team that's up. And, you know, Rangers fans for a while into the second round thought they started playing with house money. But when you're up 3-1 in the Eastern Conference Finals, the house money's out the door. You're knocking on the door one game away from the finals and five games away from hoisting the cup. And, that house money goes out the window, in my opinion, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a situation now where, you know, everybody in the hockey world talks a lot about leadership. And I know it gets talked about in all four sports. But you have a situation where, you know, the Rangers don't have a captain by captain's C on his chest. But you have a lot of guys in that room with experience. I mean, you have San Luis and Richards that won a cup together. You have a guy like Nash who's been around the league. He knows what it takes to win. And Lundqvist is a veteran. And I think, I don't know who will, usually in these, with these hockey clubs in the playoffs, you'll have somebody say something before the game. That's what you always hear as a fan. Somebody will stand up. With the Blackhawks, it's always teams, or someone will say something. I think the guy to let them know, like, enough is enough is Lundqvist, because he has stood on his head for this team for the better part of half a decade now. And he oftentimes gets inconsistent play in front of him, and he's clearly their best player by a mile.
Yeah.
And let them know, hey, you know what? This might be my last chance. This might be the one run I can take. So whether we win or lose tonight, I expect pucks to get out of our zone, and I expect you guys to get the puck in their zone and make life easier for me so I don't have to save 35. Maybe I have to save 28.
Yeah.
Help me out. Now, I'll be interested to see if they talk about that during intermission tomorrow, if somebody can let us know, you know, who kind of stood up and spoke to the Rangers before the game, because captain or no captain, you have guys that know. And then maybe San Luis will be that guy that steps up and goes, hey, look, I've been here in 2004 with Tampa. I know what it takes. And it takes a hell of a lot more than what we've done in a couple of these games because, frankly, we look loose. We look loose with the puck, and that's not good. And he's got to know it. He's got as much experience as anybody on that team.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just interested to see who steps up for him, because if you're just waiting on him, you're going to be sitting there waiting, holding the bag, because you can't just rely on one player in hockey like you can in some other sport, you know?
Yeah, all right, Cowboy, got anything else? What are your predictions for tomorrow night? You think Rangers hold it down and send us to the cup or what?
I think it'll be a tight match, but I think with the better goalie in Lundqvist, that they you have to say the Rangers are going to win on their home ice. If you go back up to Montreal, I still would have confidence in the Rangers winning because they have, you know, veterans on the team like Lundqvist, and, you know, if you look at Richards, his record in Game 7 play is unbelievable. So you have the talent and the experience there. So I still lean a little towards the Rangers, but it's not going to be easy.
God, I really love Cowboy. So there, brother, I don't know. I'm going to be down.
I'm there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I'm going to be down. You working tomorrow night, Kev? I'm going to be down at the pub tomorrow night watching the game. You going to be working?
I'll be there full force. Hey,
all right,
Santa, one quick question, Santa. What do you think about the Moore suspension that just got handed out?
Well, first of all, if you were listening a few minutes ago, I wasn't even certain that he got suspended. I thought he actually got hurt. Was that hit in last night's game? Was that the hit where he just cleaned his block?
Yeah, it was definitely a late hit.
Yeah, but I mean, I could sit here and talk for an hour, really, about the officiating in these playoffs. It's been putrid. And the one thing I've noticed is you're seeing penalties in real time that aren't called. So you're seeing no calls. And then some of the penalties that are being called, like a hooking I saw a few games ago, game two, I think it was in the Chicago-LA series, where you really had to zoom in on it in replay, and you see the ref who called it wasn't even in a position to call it. So you're seeing these egregious penalties that they're letting go, and we've seen it since the opening series with Boston and Detroit when Lucic just decided to spear the Kaiser right between his legs. And they just let it go. You're seeing awful things. You're seeing the thrust hit on Stefan. There's no penalty even called. So, you know, and the embarrassing thing for the league, and now that we have a lot of people following the game that don't ordinarily, is Commissioner Bettman hasn't even stepped up and said anything. And as a fan who's been a lifelong fan, you'd like to think maybe the commissioner would step up and go, we're going to try to do better. Because this is not good enough. This is the biggest stage for the game, and the officiating looks absolutely atrocious. And it's embarrassing because you don't even know where the hell the next whistle's coming from.
Yeah.
You know, and that's upsetting to me. All right, Kevin, we'll see you tomorrow.
All right, guys,
take
care.
All right, pal?
Yep.
All right. The Cowboy from Norwalk. Head down to South Norwalk tomorrow night if you're in the area. Check the game out over at O'Neill's Club down at South Main Street in Sono. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and break down the West a little bit. I do want to talk about my Connecticut's own goaltender Quick out there, who's just killing it.
Yeah.
Brought him back, although we got a shootout going on now in Chicago. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in about a minute with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They weren't rioters, what we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. If anyone out there.
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.weebly.com.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys, TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com, Tri-State Sports Guys, or at Tri-State_Sports. As I alluded to before the break, we got a shootout going out down in Chicago right now, 3-1, 11 minutes into the game. So I do want to talk about that series a little bit here. You know, Chicago backed up 1-0. They were a big favorite. You know, we had talked about it, I believe, on the air 2 weeks ago about the, you know, Chicago was a team that had all this firepower. They were supposed to be the team to beat. Although the Kings seemed like a deeper roster, got a great goaltender. Dean, are you surprised that the Kings went on to, you know, win the next three games, go up 3-1, put the pressure on Chicago? Is there something that surprised you with what the Kings have done during this postseason, you know, coming back against San Jose, going to a game 7 in the second round? I mean, is this surprising at all to you? I mean, although there's a tough chance.
Chicago, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of a lot of people, is they're the most talented team in the playoffs right now. They're, I think, hands down the best team. And Corey Crawford's probably the most underrated goalie in the league, if not the world. I think what you've seen in this series is Chicago plays a little bit of wide-open style. They like to get it and go. They have a lot of weapons. The three lines deep, scoring lines, the fourth line with, you know, guys like Foley. They just hit everything that moves. Their coach, Joel Quenneville, said, we have six number one defensemen. I mean, they really do have guys that could be number one defensemen on a lot of teams. You're just seeing L.A.'s Cobra-like vice grip style that shuts you down everywhere you go through the neutral zone is killing them. And then now, obviously, whatever they've done, we just turned the game on here. I believe LA just scored to make it 3-2 Chicago at the 13-16 mark in the first. But I think you've seen Chicago get choked off this entire series. I've watched every game, and everywhere they've gone, that neutral zone trap employed by the LA Kings has stymied them at every single turn. And it's made Crawford look like a bad goaltender, which I think is ridiculous, because he's outstanding. And the fact that he didn't even get consideration for Team Canada during the Olympics is unreal, because he's right there in terms of top five goalies in the league. But, yeah, it is extremely surprising, even though you have a couple teams that have won the Cup in the past couple of years. I don't think I expected this.
Yeah.
Really, as I watch it, I'm more surprised by that than I am by the Rangers when they went up 3-1.
Yeah.
I'm far more surprised that the Hawks have looked kind of as porous as they have at times.
Now, Neil, I know you're more of a casual hockey fan, but are you a guy that's still you know, locked in to the Western Conference and following this series at all?
Yeah, I am, and you know, I wasn't really sure who to pull for, you know, heading into it, you know, but I think I'd rather see the Blackhawks advance. I don't know what it is about the Kings that gets me so upset. I don't know if the Devils in 2012, but you know, it's interesting to me to watch the Kings, because, you know, they're not you know, they're never the favorite going into the postseason, but yet they have a bunch of players or a core set of players that seems to come together and play well in the postseason. And, you know, picking up Marion Gaborik with another, like, amazing trade before the deadline, it, you know, seems to be what is propelling them in this series. You know, and the fact that the Blackhawks have been really horrible on the power play and the penalty kill, both you know, this series they've just been atrocious on the special teams. So I think Los Angeles has taken advantage of that. And it's interesting to see that Crawford doesn't kind of look like the normal Crawford that a lot of people have come to expect. You know, he's let in a couple goals that, you know, normally he block. So, you know, there was some talk about, you know, maybe he's getting inside his own head and putting too much pressure on himself, but I don't know if that's the case.
I think the Kings, I mean, I agree with you. I'd rather see the Hawks get to the finals. I love Duncan Keith. I love Jonathan Toews. But the Kings, to me, are fun. You got Dustin Brown, the Japanese American. You got Quick, who you mentioned, Mike, the Connecticut boy in goal. You got Matty Green, the Michigan guy on D. I mean, they have some American guys you can kind of hang your hat on. So do the Hawks, but I think the better series, certainly for the league, that they might probably hoping for in the league offices up in Toronto, would certainly be another original six matchup with Chicago and whoever comes out of the East. That'd be great. But I think what you see in hockey come playoff time is what people always talk about in baseball in terms of, you know, pitching and defense is going to win games for you in baseball, especially in the playoffs. And I think in hockey, what you get is goaltending takes the place of pitching. And the defensive side of things that I think you hear a lot of the experts, which I'm not, but a lot of the experts talk about is control of the neutral zone. And when you see the difficulties Chicago's had getting the puck through from blue line to blue line, it's been amazing in the series, especially given the skill, the puck-carrying ability of the Blackhawks players, and the speed that they have. Really, like I said, three lines deep. Had a lot of difficulty against the Kings team that's probably, I mean, you mentioned Gaborik, guys like Kopitar that can really skate. But I don't think they have the skaters the Blackhawks have. They just choked them off at every turn and made the red line almost impossible to gain to even get pucks in. And now here you're seeing a 3-2 game where it seems from what I've seen in these first couple minutes like the Hawks are flying up and down through the neutral zone. So I don't know if maybe L.A. changed something up in their game plan or whatever. But, Neil, is this more surprising to you, the Hawks being down 3-1, than the Rangers being up 3-1 when they were?
I honestly would have said that the Rangers being up 3-1, if you had said to me before the series started, Rangers up 3-1, I would have been more surprised. Because the Kings have that knack for, to me, they have that knack of just, I don't know, digging deep and playing really, you know, exceptional hockey in the postseason. The Rangers, to me, it's like they barely squeak past the Flyers. It takes a Herculean effort to come back against the Penguins. So, yeah, they had the momentum. But, you know, as we talked through it, you know, in previewing that series, it just seemed like Montreal had the edge. And, you know, once Price went down, I thought, oh, well, then now the Rangers are a shoe-in for the finals, just, you know, pencil them in. And then, you know, Tchorsky just he's proven himself to be, you know, better than we all thought. So, to me, it's more interesting, you know, that the Rangers are up 3-1 or surprising, because you know, the Kings are sneaky that way in my mind. I don't know what it is, but they seem underrated. You know, people to kind of take them for granted, and you know, they showed what their capacity for, you know, coming back in the San Jose series. They did it to the Blues. I think they did it to the Blues last year, where, you know, the Blues looked like they had it sewn up, and then they come back. So, you know, for me, I think the Rangers being up is more surprising.
You know, I'm of the mind, and I have been for years, and I know it's up for debate, so I'm not saying I'm right, but it's always been my opinion that the Stanley Cup is the toughest championship to win in the four major sports, so solely because it is a physical contact game. The games are 60 minutes long. The puck's in play all 60 minutes. There's no time between huddles. You don't get a week off. I know football's, you know, a possibly a little bit more tiring, physically demanding game. But I think I've seen it kind of bear itself out over the years in terms of teams that make those lengthy series, those 6- and 7-game series. It seems to benefit them oftentimes. But every year I hear the same rhetoric that so-and-so played 7 games. They just played 7 games, so they're going to be tired. They're not going to have their legs under them. And what you see with the Rangers is a pair of game sevens to get here, and you see the same thing with the Kings. They needed 7 to overcome San Jose. They needed 7 to overcome the Ducks. And you're just seeing now two teams that have had to play a lot of hockey. Montreal got a sweep in the first round. And for the first couple games of the series, even through a second-round series they had to play against Boston that did go 7, they did look tired. And they had played 3 less games than the New York Rangers at that point. And, you know, the Hawks have not played as much hockey, not that it was possible, but they haven't played as much hockey as the Kings. And you're seeing two teams that have played a lot. So are you of that mind, Neil, where you think it maybe hardens you, battle tests you a little bit, playing more games, or are you the guy, which is fine, but are you the guy that thinks that maybe your legs aren't beneath you a little bit because you've had to play so much hockey?
Obviously it depends on what kind of team you have. I mean, I don't know that you can just lump everyone into that same category. I mean, if you have a team that's younger, then your legs are not going to be too much of an issue versus an older team with a lot more veterans, I think. Of course, you know, the veterans have more experience, so they know how to maybe conserve their energy. To me, you look at the Rangers squad, and if you remember a couple weeks ago, we talked about, you know, their roster and their success rate in Game 7s. I mean, that goes a long way. So, I mean, you know, if the Rangers do end up going to a Game 7, you know, you're not as confident because they're in Montreal where they don't play as well, but at the same time, they've proven themselves to be, you know, a team that can come together and play well in a Game 7. So, it's tough to say. I mean, you look at the NBA, too. I mean, I know it's a different sport, but, the Heat, they just don't go to Game 7s very often. So, I mean, there are teams that thrive off of that, you know, being able to being battle-tested and being there before and knowing what the experience is like and using it to their advantage. If I don't know, man, if I'm the Rangers, I want to end this in 6.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, I kind of thought throughout all my years watching that hockey's the kind of sport where you need to stay sharp. Now, you need to stay sharp in any sport, but I think it is a sport where your skating stride, I think your system, every team at that level, like they are at levels just below, whether it's major, junior, or college hockey, they're system-oriented teams. I think playing more hockey kind of has a way of keeping you a little bit fresher. It seems like it would kind of work against itself, but I think it does help you to know, hey, look, you know, we just finished a series a couple days ago or 3 days ago, and we got to get back on the horse. Montreal had a long wait in between that Tampa series and starting off with the Bruins. And, you know, they looked a little flat at times early in both series, both with the Bruins and with the Rangers. But I have a question for you just as, you know, a little discussion I've had with a few of my hockey buddies, but the question I have is, you know, if you exclude the goaltenders and you just take position players, if you're starting to draft with these last 4 teams that are left in these playoffs, who's the guy that would be at the top of Neil Lynch's draft board? No goalies, just the position players. You're starting a team tomorrow.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, I tend to think I would like the guy who's in the same vein as a Jaromír Jágr or someone who is, you know, I know that, you know, speed kills, but I like a guy that has that vision and can set people up and can see the path that no one else can. I think that's an incredible skill and to create plays where there aren't. That's the kind of guy that I'm hoping for. I don't know if that's necessarily a center or if it is a winger, but you know, I really like a guy who can set people up, and then a close second to me is just a big body that you can just stick right in front of the goaltender who is immovable and just serves the brick wall, the blockade. I mean, the guy that is just basically the filter. You know, he's screening the goalie. He can't get a clear view of the puck and his path. and can deflect the puck. I mean, you know, those are the two guys that I'm targeting.
So you're basically going, your first theory would be like a Jonathan Toews, and your second theory would be along the lines of like a Dustin Brown. You want the puck mover playmaker and the big tough lug nut who can make plays, because, you know, Dustin Brown is a very underrated offensive player, but he does stand in front of that net. He's got no teeth. You know what I mean? Like, his teeth are just knocked out of his skull, and he stands there. He'll take a puck to the mouth. He's not worried about it. The discussion I was having with a few of my buddies was Jonathan Toews, to me, is the clear-cut choice if you could take a position player of these teams left, because he does everything you mentioned. You know? I mean, he's winning roughly 72% of his faceoffs, which is unbelievable. He's a great two-way player. But I'm going to go with my boy, Duncan Keith. If you're starting a team, Mike.
Duncan Keith?
I start, and I believe this is the way most teams do it, from the crease out. I want the great goalie, which we took him off the board. Can't pick him. But I think he did take Lundqvist. Don't you take Lundqvist? You drafted a goalie right now.
Connecticut Dome. Jonathan
Quick. I can't argue with that. I can't argue with any of them.
Jonathan Quick has shown in the playoffs that I could put a team on his back.
No, he can't.
You can give me percentages and this and that. Jonathan Quick has done it. He's doing it right now during this playoff run. Does it like, you know, out here in the East.
Did it in the Olympics.
Did it in the Olympics.
Yeah.
This is a guy, I'm taking Jonathan Quick.
Well, I mean, let's not forget, when Lundqvist had a great team in front of him, he won a gold medal.
Okay.
But I agree. I mean, I can't argue that. I mean, you know, even if you took Carey Price when he's healthy, he's clearly there. But the discussion we're having was if you could pick a player. So Neil was saying he wants that playmaker type, which is Jonathan Toews. He's clear cut. But we excluded him from our draft, figuring he's the number one pick for everybody. Duncan Keith's the guy. I mean, he is the guy in these playoffs. He's my favorite player to watch play, hands down, in the whole league. Does everything perfectly and beautifully and great. He's tough. And if you remember in 2010, he took a puck right in his teeth, and the headline of the Chicago paper was Duncan Keith. Knocked five teeth out of the front of his head. He went in, got his little cuts stitched up, didn't miss a shit. He's back on the ice in 3 minutes.
Well, along that lane, the guy I'm taking – is not a guy who's going to score. He's a defenseman. Derek Stepan. He broke his jaw, did he not? Was he out there playing last night?
Yeah, he's a center.
He's a center, but he's not a goal scorer.
No, he's a very solid player. He's one of my favorite players on the Rangers team. And you know what? We were talking last night, a few of us. It's just, it's refreshing to see guys that don't care about themselves.
Especially guys, to go away from the sport a little bit, especially guys, like, if you want to talk about, like, models who they like, they love the hockey guys.
Can you blame them?
So the pretty boy, like, you know, Tom Brady's of the world that keep all nice and clean, that's not – I mean, although he's got a model girlfriend, the crazy supermodel girls, they're going after the hockey players who don't care if their face looks different 60 minutes later after the puck drop. They don't care. Like, my face just looks different than it did yesterday.
I will tell you this. For our listeners, just Google Jonathan Toews' girlfriend. She's one of the three or four best-looking women you'll ever see. But I'll tell you what is, like, super fun for me, you know, this time of year with the playoffs and the way these guys just go at it, is, like, how many times can I see Mark Teixeira on the DL because he's got a limp? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not comparing the two sports because they're obviously very different. But you see these baseball players and they got, like, turf toe or something's bothering them just a little bit. My co-host here, he just Googled Jonathan Toews' girlfriend. And he's surprised at how good looking she is. So, but yeah, I mean, I just love that about hockey. That these guys, I don't know if you saw Ryan Getzlaf in the Ducks series. He took a puck to his chin. He got like 16 stitches. He was back on the ice like 5 minutes later. It's just refreshing that these guys put, even the elite players, put everything in front of themselves. And I really do think when you boil it down, you know how much I'm into hustle and everything, which I'd like to talk about that later.
Okay.
I have a new theory on my Robinson Cano theory that we'll get into in a little bit. But that's my favorite thing about hockey. These guys just, they don't care about their numbers. It's all about winning that cup. And it's awesome. I mean, how could you not like that? I think that's even getting to some of the people on here we were talking before we got on the air. It's like hockey fever.
Yeah.
And it's not because hockey games are 1-9 to 5. Like, you know, there's not a ton of scoring. It's because the game is just so awesome and so tough. It's great. Even you have to love that.
Love it.
Pretty
man.
Mike DePalma.
Let's be honest. I'm not pretty.
Beautiful.
No, let's be honest. I'm a little big around the gut. But, all right, let's take a quick break. We'll get back. We'll transition over to a little Major League Baseball. I know we did start the show with some Cubby talk. That will be the only Cubby talk we give all game long, all show long. I'm positive of that. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll break down some New York Mets clubhouse shakeup a little bit. Maybe talk about whatever you guys talk about Robinson Cano. I'm excited to hear that because I love him more than anybody else. We're the Tri-State Sports Guys. We'll be right back.
These days, my dollar just doesn't go as far. In my car, it gets me about 6 miles. On my cell phone, maybe 4 minutes. But at McDonald's, my dollar gets me through the entire day. From sausage McMuffin with egg for breakfast to a tasty double cheeseburger. Thanks to McDonald's Dollar Menu, my dollar gets me right where I want to be. Satisfied.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys, tri-statesportsguys.com, facebook.com/tri-statesportsguys, or on Twitter at tri-state_sports. Neil, a lot of doing in Queens over the last couple of days, and they fire their hitting coach. They dump Jose Valverde, which means both the experiments, the veteran experience experiments they had out in the bullpen with Farnsworth and Valverde, both have not lasted 2 full months. What did you make of it? Neil, I think you're kind of a fan of what they did with the hitting coach. I got to imagine you didn't have any love lost between you and Jose Valverde. What do you think of the moves the Mets made this week?
I like it. And, you know, a lot of people are coming down hard on the Mets executives and saying that, it's a reflection of how poorly run the organization is. I think this is a sign that the organization has actually had enough. They will no longer stand for failure, and they're going to make moves to ensure that more fans come out of the ballpark. There was a stat or graphic that put up during the game yesterday or the day before where the Mets lead the majors in 0-1 counts. It means that they're taking the first pitch regardless. And, you know, sometimes if you see your pitch first pitch, just grip it and rip it. You know, and it's amazing how many opportunities they might have missed out on if they hadn't had this kind of, whoever had this kind of, mandate or edicts, you know, if it's Hudgens or someone else saying that you got to make the pitchers work the count, you know, work the count, work the count. It's all well and good, but if you're missing your pitch along the way, then, who knows how many hits that they sacrificed just to work the count and get the pitch count up. So, to me, Kevin Burkhardt interviewed the new hitting coach, Lamar Johnson, and, that's exactly what he said. He was like, you see your pitch, you hit it, enough clowning around already, obviously we tried the one approach and it didn't work, and so we got to start swinging the bat and being more aggressive, and, I think one of the other items that they mentioned was the old hitting coach, Hudgens. This might have been one of his philosophies, too, is that you want to ignore the outside and inside, portions of the plate. So if you got a pitch that's borderline outside, borderline inside, take it. Just take it, straight up take it, and let the umpire make that decision. And majority of the time they'll call it a ball or something like that. Well, that's ludicrous. You have to wait for something to come down the pipe in order to take a hack? I mean, some guys thrive on the inside part of the plate. Some guys love to go to oppo, with the outside portion of the plate. So, I am all for being a little more aggressive in the batter's box. As far as Valverde goes, I mean, it was cool to see him, surprise us in the first couple games. But, he just wasn't getting the job done. And, Farnsworth wasn't exactly a sure thing either. So, for me, it's like I'm all for them experimenting a little bit with the bullpen, not having a solidified closer. Go with your hot hand if you have one, but, really rotate. Don't always depend on Mejia to get it done. If Familia is available, get Familia up and going. If Daisuke is a guy that you think, is fresh, then use him. I don't think that you need to abide by this standard that you have to have a lights out closer. You just got to go with a guy that you think has a live arm that looks good in the bullpen.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But back to the hitting instructor, I couldn't agree with you more, Danny. Neil, and I want to ask you, Danny, as a guy, I mean, I understand the idea, and it's great when you have a hitter like a Joey Votto who's super patient and can wait for his pitch. But if you just get down to the nuts and bolts of baseball, it's about you might get in the major league level one pitch to hit, and you got to hit it. And whether that pitch comes in the first pitch of the at-bat or the eighth pitch, after you fight off some tough ones, you got to execute on that bat. And so a lot of times when you see guys go in the slumps, and you say, they get tough 0-2 pitches. Well, the reason that they're 0-2 is either because they took their pitch to the hit or they missed it and fouled it off. And so, I think a lot of guys want to really mold young hitters, inexperienced hitters at the major league level, into taking pitches. All you ever hear, you'd like to see the guy take more pitches. You'd like to see him work more walks. I actually think you go in the other direction. Let the guy have some success at the major league level, being aggressive. And as you mature, you learn that. That's not, to me, being patient at the plate, although it seems like just a mental thing, it's not. It really isn't. It's something that you have to physically learn to lay off the pitch you're not going to hit, and the more pitches you see, you can't pound that into a guy's head because it does get into their head. And to be passive at the plate is to be non-existent at the plate, in my opinion. I'd much rather see the young guys get out there and be aggressive. And then learn, like your boy Starlin Castro. I mean, that guy doesn't walk, and he's young. Eventually he will, and he'll learn, but he goes out there, and he looks for his pitch to hit, and he drives it. Look at C.J. Cron out in Anaheim, the same way. I mean, the guy gets the pitch to hit, and he drives it. And I like that kind of approach, and I think that they do a disservice to guys like Lucas Duda and the rest to say, you got to wait, just work the count. You're going to get your pitch later on. Work a good count, because if the first pitch is there, you got to hack at it, Danny, no?
Well, it's very difficult, I thought, that for a long time, we heard kind of the theories out in Oakland where they take a lot of pitches, work out and stuff. I always thought it's very difficult to change your hitter's approach.
100%.
At the plate. It's not easy, but I would say it's easier to change his mechanics at the plate. You have a guy, and everybody around here was talking about it, like Ike Davis with the big pitch. But, there's been successful guys that had hitches,
Gary Sheffield.
Absolutely. And you got a guy like Mel Ott in the old photos. You see him, his hands were down by his knee when the ball was halfway to the plate.
Yeah.
That guy hit 500 homers. But I would bet you dollars to donuts it was Mel Ott's approach at the plate where he knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
You try to change a hitter, and I've heard a lot of the stuff in the NL Central watching the Cubs all the time about Votto. They're saying you have to expand your strike zone when it's an RBI situation, and he said, why?
Yeah.
Why do I have to do that? Why? And it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
He hits the way he hits. He's patient.
It's like David Wright does that. I mean, David Wright gets criticized because, he'll take the walk, but it's better than rolling one over to the shortstop.
It's better than rolling over to shortstop, and David Wright is in a completely different situation than that. I mean, Joey Votto has helped in that lineup when you look at some of the hitters he has there. Why would you want Joey Votto rolling over a pitch a couple of years ago if he's got Brandon Phillips in mind?
Yeah.
Or if he's got Jay Bruce in mind. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. So my theory is if a guy's approach is, I don't like swinging 3-0.
Yeah.
I don't like swinging 3-0. I don't hit the right field well as a right-handed batter. I just don't. We'll work on it, but in the meantime, pull the ball as hard as you can. I just don't get it.
You work on things in practice. You don't work on things in the game.
No, and that's why you hear people say, pitching coach comes out to the bump, he's not going over this guy's mechanics with him. He might be going over, let's just, get ahead of this guy or whatever. But that's not the time to start talking about arm slot. That's what you do in the bullpen at 2:30 in the afternoon when the guy's got his session and you talk to him about, look, here's some of the mechanical stuff we got to go over. But you change mechanics, you adjust mechanics. I don't know if you ever change approach, because I think you talk about it a lot, and I agree with some of the stuff you say about it. You get a guy who's a little bit of a hot dog. Maybe it takes an edge off his game to try to, put a leash on him. I think the same thing is true. If you try to tell Kirby Puckett in the prime of his career, hey, look, when it's 2-0, don't swing the ball up at your letters, and he goes, why? I just hit a ball 380 the right side for a double. I mean, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
There's some guys that's just the way they hit.
Well, that's just one of the things that I have a problem with that Hudson said. I think he was on with Francesa. And he said, people are saying that I want guys to take pitches, and then, and they use as evidence guys taking pitches right down the chute. I never told anybody to take a pitch on the chute, but you're getting – that's just as proof that you're getting in guys' heads. Guys have been hitting pitches. Every guy at the major league level has been crushing balls down the middle of the plate. But when you start getting into people's heads and they're thinking too much, I will tell you the best way to hit is to have just a clear, completely clear head. You go up to the plate with an approach. You get into the box. I used to sit there. I used to count to eight. I used to take a deep breath, count to eight, get into the box, and not think about anything. And I think that's the approach. And then you just react. You use everything you've done in practice, use everything else, and if you're practicing taking pitches off the edge of the plate in batting practice or you know, in the cage or whatever you're doing, I think it'll translate to the field. And, you know, to kind of spin off what we're talking about with the Mets, but just an overall mindset in baseball right now that you hear from sports talk hosts and you hear from fans, which drives me insane, is that obviously right now the movement in baseball is this shift, this overloaded shift to the left-handed, for left-handed batters, especially, you know, the power guys. And everybody in the world says, drop down a bunt, or why are they just going the other way? And they're acting like going the other way, that's just proof you've never played the game. That's acting like, oh, you just, what do you do? You're just going to take a 96-mile-an-hour pitch and fourth break, just inside out and hit the other way. They act like it's just no big deal.
Those are the people that we talk about that they're stupid, but those are the people now that are kind of the shot callers in Major League Baseball. They're people, you get the rare exception like a Billy Bean, a guy who played the game, but most people are pencil-pushing little nerds that they're trying to tell us now how the game needs to be played. Now, I understand the kind of theory that you want a guy to work on hitting the ball the other way. You know what I mean? But then you could make the argument, you know, Ted Williams never hit the ball the other way. That is like almost 350.
I've read his book, The Science of Hitting by Ted Williams,
yeah.
And he spends a decent amount of time talking about hitting the ball the other way, but he didn't hit the ball the other way. He actually talked about how you hit the ball the other way, the approach you do, what you do with your hips. You still want to drive the ball with your hips to drive it the other way, but he didn't do it because there are swings in baseball that don't allow themselves to really go the other way, and there are approaches that don't allow them to go the other way. And so why are you going? You made it to the major league. You got a guy like Mark Teixeira. Everybody always wants to talk about Mark Teixeira. This guy has had big time success at the major league level. As much as everybody wants to bash him, this guy has put up borderline Hall of Fame numbers to this point in his career. I don't care what you say, we're talking about power, RBI, slugging percentage, and the rest. And now all of a sudden, you want this guy who's done everything he's done since he's 5 years old till he's 33 years old, and he's like, oh, give me Mark, why don't you just try to drive the ball into left center? That's something you could do from the left side of the plate, right?
I'll tell you this. I do agree with theory, and I see it with the Cubs, with Rizzo. He's got 5 fun hits. I do agree with that. I do agree with a left-handed batter learning to do that. And, you know, if you're not going to complain about the shift,
yeah.
But Rizzo had said audibly, you could hear him in an interview say, you know, I'm not a big fan of it. Well, it's like, well, then if it's getting in your head, then you have to figure something out. I'm not telling Anthony Rizzo to try to drive the ball through the six hole. What I am telling him is lay down the bunt. And you know what the best part is now? The third baseman's playing on the cut of the grass right about where the shortstop would be because they know he will bunt.
Yeah. Well,
that's
the
difference.
To become a slot hitter. You could sit there and work on learning a bunt, especially from the left side.
That's what I'm saying.
I didn't learn to bunt really because I never really bunted growing up. Who the hell bunted? But learned to bunt later on in life. No, you know, just, and it's something you could do, and that doesn't impact your swing. It doesn't impact what you do in batting practice. I don't disagree with the idea of laying down a bunt. It does not, not that bunting is overly easy, but learning to sit there and say, in my first pitch, I'm going to show bunt, and if I get a pitch on the outside part of the plate, or I get a pitch down, and I can get down the left, third baseline, I'll do it. That is completely different than sitting there saying, oh, I'm going to learn to drive the ball the other way.
Well, I think the same people that are, handing down the math numbers down to the dugout are the people that never probably played, and they're telling you, you know what, as simply as we put these numbers together to line these fielders where we feel they need to be, is how simply you should be able to just hit the ball through the six hole. But it's, we talked about a few weeks ago, Augie Garrido, the legendary University of Texas coach, said it's a zero-sum game. From pitch to pitch, you never know what's going to happen. Luis Soho could hit a homer on a pitch that Barry Bonds would pop up. I mean, it's a game that can't be solved by numbers. So the people that are telling these guys, hit the ball the other way, like I saw Chris Young, right-handed batter with the Mets, have a shift on him the other day. You don't see that a lot. You don't see a lot of right-hand batters have full shifts put on them.
Yeah.
But he did. Now, if that's something that bothers him and gets in his head, then he might want to learn how to push a bunt down to right field toward second base. If he looks at you and goes, you know, I don't care, I don't even notice it, then good on you, man. Go ahead and hit. Do whatever you want. Get right into the teeth of the shift. But if it gets in your head, which Rizzo said, you know, I find it a little bit annoying when I look out there, well, he sat down with the hitting coach, and they went over some different things, and he's dropping bunts out. He didn't want to San Diego over the weekend. That's all I'm saying. I don't want a guy like Mark Teixeira, and I agree with you. I don't want a guy that we're paying $20-plus million a year to hit the ball out of the ballpark and produce runs. I don't want him trying to slap the ball to left field like he's Tony Gwynn or Wade Boggs. But if they're going to shift and you're in a 1-1 game in the eighth inning and there's nobody on base, there's no outs, and there's nobody at third base vacated, I would expect the big leaguer to have put the time in who knows he's getting shifted to lay a bunt down. I would expect him to know how to do it at that point. And people that say those power hitters in the big leagues, they never had to bunt, okay, fine. I understand that. But they don't have anything else to do during the afternoon. Go in the cage, go on the field, learn how to bunt, lay
a
bunt down. Help
day.
Your team. That's a way to help your team.
Exactly, and that's something you can do in the offseason.
How many balls could you bunt in 15 minutes?
A lot.
Exactly. That's
a million.
The point.
And you could even have the guy throwing you BP. Because, you know, Neil, this is my next question. I mean, you could have a guy throwing BP working you inside. Because, Neil, if you're a pitcher and you get a lefty up at bat and you're shifted over in the right side, I mean, where are you pitching him?
I'm pitching him in.
You're going to try to pitch him in, make him pull that ball, and which you a major league hitter other than a Derek Jeter or a Joey Votto or Wade Boggs back in the day or Tony Gwynn, they're not going to be able to take a pitch on the inner half and drive it the other way. You know what they're going to do? If they try to hit it the other way, they're going to pop it up. That's just the fact of the matter. So, but you could bunt the pitch inside the other way. Especially at the left-hand side, you can kind of bail out, you know what I mean, start leaving towards first base and bunt it down the other way. And that puts a lot of pressure on a lot of guys. You know, puts pressure on the pitcher, puts pressure obviously on third base. You get down there when they have that shift on themselves, you know, and all you're saying is hit it foul or hit it down the third baseline. And that's it. And as again, like you said, you could do it. So, I mean, Neil, as a pitcher, you know, we never did that in college when I played with you, the big shift. But would that change your approach as a pitcher? I would assume it would, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it just frightens me knowing that there's a humongous hole on one side of the field. You know, I've never been a fan of the shift, but they've released statistics that it works, you know, and it definitely helps the defense. You know, a lot of people criticize the Yankees for shifting too much, but as a pitcher, it scares the bejesus out of me because I know if I mess up at all, you know, put it where it's not supposed to be, then you know, even if the guy has a history of not being able to place it somewhere that he, you know, knowing my luck, he would. So the pitcher, I hate it, but if it, you know, statistics show numbers never lie, then I'll go along with it. I'm just not a huge fan.
Yeah, I agree. I don't mean to, you know, get away from what we're talking about with the Mets, but it's just something that has irked me to no end. Especially this season. We've been saying it for a while, talking heads of the world and the idiots on Facebook about just why don't we just go the other way with it? It's like, oh, is that that simple? You're dealing with a 96-mile-an-hour cutter on your hands, and you just, why can't you just drive the ball into left field? That's no big deal.
I'm not blaming everything on the people that I'm mentioning, but the fact of the matter is that the minute you try to pretend that baseball is easy or that baseball is a numbers game, is when you start getting into this stuff. And you know what? It's only going to get, depending on how you want to phrase it, I would phrase it, it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get crazier with these shifts. It's all it's going to do.
Yeah. And but like Neil said, it is working.
No, it's absolutely working. That's what I'm saying. It's going to get more and more accurate, and it's going to get more and more acute in terms of we got to have our second baseman right here in shallow right field. But this is where the guy hits the ball 3 out of 150 times in the second base. You know what I mean? I watch games and they pan out from behind home plate, and I'm like, this is unreal to me.
It doesn't bother me, though.
No, it doesn't bother me, but it's like, I can't believe that this is what it's become.
Yeah.
Never when we were kids, you didn't see any of this.
No, never.
I don't, people
would. You didn't see any of it 10 years ago.
No, but people would tell us the game's evolved.
Right.
Okay, fine.
But it's,
fine.
You know what? But I mean, when did it start? With Ted Williams way back in the day, right. And then it went away from it, and now they're back to it.
Which I can't believe they got away with that then, because the thing was just throwing a guy's head. I can't believe that was the case back then. You ever thought about that? They shifted Ted Williams, and you think that the Red Sox pitching staff would have just hit the opposing second baseman in the skull with a salt cap every time he came up. Like, they just let him get away with it. Like, it was stunning to me then. Nowadays, you can't throw at anybody without your manager getting thrown out for the next 5 years, and everybody on your team's got to do, like, pennants.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't throw at anyone.
You got to run wires up now.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's just, it, to me, I don't know. I just think now you get into trouble scoring things. You score something 5-4-3, but it was the shortstop that threw him out. Like,
yeah.
So, who are these guys behind the scenes, like in the Wizard of Oz, they're behind this curtain doing all these numbers, going, this is exactly what this guy is. Oh, doesn't bother you at all?
It doesn't bother me. The shift doesn't bother me. No, I just get, the point of the game is to win. So whatever you can do to win, and clearly, like Neil said, the numbers bear it out that it worked, I don't have a problem with that at all. Not even a little bit. But it just bothers me the talking point on the other side of like, oh, well, they got to adjust. Adjustments meaning you want to bunt is one thing. I agree with you. It doesn't impact your swing or your approach at the plate. But this idea that all of a sudden you're going to have guys that have been pulling the ball out of the ballpark their whole career can all of a sudden just say, oh, yeah, I'll just take that ball the other way. You get a pitch in the outside park, you take the other way. But it's not something that anybody could do. Even a park down the chute, you've been trained your entire life, if you're one of those power guys, to take that ball and put it over the right center field fence. And now all of a sudden you want to say, just wait a little bit.
Because that's what I said. It's like they think hitting is easy because they're putting things together from afar. And it's not. And if you ever faced anybody that threw 90-plus, you know that it's not easy to just say, you know what I'm going to do here? I'm just going to wait an extra 1/8 of a second and drive this ball through the porthole. It doesn't work like
that. It's not even like that.
It doesn't work like that.
It's not. Because as a swing, you can't just be, I'm going to wait a little extra second.
No, you can
look
for
a ball. Yeah.
But these people think, like, you know what the sheriff should do? He should just wait for that 97-mile-an-hour fastball on the outside corner, just that extra 1/1000th of a second, and drive a ball to left field. Drive it as a park.
Yeah.
He should.
Yeah, just put it
but
in the
But it's not like that. And that's the problem I have with baseball. As I see a shift, and sometimes I just shake my head going, I know this isn't Joe Girardi's idea. This is coming from higher up or something, and it's changing the game. And I guess that's fine. You're right. The point is to win the game.
I have no problem.
To get as many outs as you can. I understand that. Excuse me.
I
just
do think
at, like,
it's kind of
coming from my mind.
What's that, Neil?
I do think it's kind of odd, though, that Big Poppy, I don't know. I mean, he's had the shift on him for so long. You think that. And, well, you know, I guess he's still successful, so why change? But it just seems odd to me that that doesn't – maybe it's just a testament to the kind of person he is, but it doesn't irk him at all that he hasn't tried once to bunt or try to go the other way. It's mind-blowing. If that were me, it would drive me nuts, and I would just want to do – just try to once to see how it would go.
Didn't he get a bunt double last year at Fenway?
He did. He had a bunt double last year. And I also think Big Poppy is a complete hitter. I've seen him drive the ball off the monster. I just think when you step into the box, it's about pitching. It's about hitting the ball where the ball is pitched.
Well, the theory,
get a guy, he can hit the ball the other way.
The theory with his shift, if I'm not mistaken, is where he hits the ball on the ground, right?
Yeah.
Because you're right. He will drive the ball over the monster to left field. But they say, I guess, he doesn't hit choppers through the six holes.
There's not a lot of guys that are ever going to hit choppers. I mean, just to break down baseball, because, you know, most of the time you're early, you hit the ball on the ground, and if you're late, you pop the ball up. And so if you're hitting the ball the other way, a lot of times it is in the air, and if you're hitting the ball, pulling the ball, a lot of times it is on the ground. So that is something that's, you know, relatively consistent, you know, it's in the baseball. But let's go out to Tucci Lumber Hotline. And again, if you want to call us, 347-637-2306, we've got a couple people waiting here on hold. We're going to go out to line number two. My main man, Nick T. from Norwalk. Nick, how we doing, brother?
What's going on, guys? I hear you talking about the shift over there. I hate the shift, to be honest with you. And I'm looking at it as a defensive. It's starting to hurt the Yankees. For example, I'm going to use the Yankees. It's starting to hurt the Yankees defensively. I think that it's cost them 10 outs so far this season, shifting. I mean, so I'm not looking at
just,
it,
I mean, people being out of place.
I'm looking at it defensively. It's starting to screw the. They shift second, but they're the most. They shift more behind. They're second behind the Astros for teams that shift the most. I mean, when did this? I mean, I don't know when. I mean, last year they didn't shift that much, but they're shifting for everybody. They're shifting in between pitches. They're shifting in between. You know, it seems like every other batter they got a shift coming on. Especially with Roberts.
Yeah. I think that eventually it will wind up evening itself out because, I mean, you do put yourself defensively in a position where now you've got your third baseman covering on double plays. You've got people all out of position. You're playing your second baseman. I'm amazed at how well these second basemen field the ball 15 feet into the outfield. That's something you've never been asked to do, ball hitting the infield grass, hitting the infield dirt, hitting the outfield grass, and then you're fielding this ball. It amazes me that more of these second basemen don't make errors, but you're putting everybody in a place they've never been. And just like we're talking about hitters being in a comfort zone, doing something, the same thing they've done their entire life, you're now asking these defenders to do the exact same thing. I agree with you. I think eventually there will be a shift kind of where it'll be a little less used. I think that this year, 2014, it's been more prevalent across the league than any other time. It's why it's getting all this attention.
It's up,
you know,
I saw a stat. It was up 13% this year. 13% teams are shifting more this year than last year. And it's on pace for some record 33% more total shifts this year. I mean, I don't know where these guys – I mean, it's all that sabermetric stuff. I mean, I look at that fan – I got a Fangraphs subscription. I look at – it's all that those guys talk about is the sabermetric, advanced fielding metric. I mean, the stuff is just crazy. I don't know where they – you know, I mean, I understand where they're getting the numbers from, but to buy into it, the data is too – there's not enough data out there to buy into it, is my opinion. And just the way I look at it, it just kills the game defensively. I've seen Brian Roberts get screwed out of how many double play assists because he's fielding, you know what I mean? He's in the middle of the outfield. You got Flaherty coming over playing, you know, behind second base. You got Jeter over there trying to cover third. You know, it's just a mess. So
yeah, it almost seems like this year is that this is the experiment year where this is going to shift those numbers because – you know, I'm sure there are all millions of spray charts. We've been looking at spray charts since the 80s. We look at where guys are hitting the ball. And I'm sure, like, you know, Danny said about Big Poppy pulling the ball on the ground a lot. We're going to move our guy over there. But how much does that impact the rest of the thing? And I think that this year is the year we're going to get data, real data, that tells you what the impact is. Like you said, Danny, I mean, they've been putting a shift on, or maybe it was Neil that said, they've been putting the shift on Poppy for a while, still a 330, 110 guy every year. So what would he be if they didn't put the shift on? Was he in at 400? I mean, he's able to still hit the ball around the yard in other places. I think this is going to be the year where after, like, if Nick is correct and it's going to be 33% more and it's going to be a record-breaking year, you're going to be able to pull his data out and say, had we not done the shift, here's what the numbers would have been. Had we done this shift, you know, we have done the shift. Here's what the numbers really were, and was it worthwhile, and do we pull it back? And I think that at the end of the day, you are going to see that the shift maybe doesn't work as across the board as you've seen. I mean, they put the shift on almost any left-hander. They put the shift on Matt Adams all the time.
They're putting shifts on everybody. They're putting shifts on guys batting 210. I mean, they're putting shifts on guys who you know what I don't understand? They got a runner on first, and they're putting the shift on a right-hander over and shifting everybody over and leaving the whole, you know what I mean, the whole second left side of the bag field wide open. And I don't understand where they're getting the data to shift on certain guys. I can understand Poppy, and I can see Teixeira and some of these guys, but, I mean, I'm using the Yankees again as an example. I mean, they're shifting on everybody. I mean, everybody. They're shifting on guys batting 210. I just don't understand it. But I mean, if they see something that I don't, let them do it. I just can't understand it for the life of me. But my point is, I'm looking at it as it's starting to hurt teams defensively. I think you start to see less double play assists, you know, and less double plays, and you know what I mean? Guys are just playing out of position. It's affected the Yankees. I was trying to keep count at one point. I was up to, I think it cost the Yankees 10 outs to shift because of, you know, guys not in position to turn a correct double play and whatnot. So, you know, I'm starting to look at it. Guys that are able to, you know, drop the bat and, you know, go the other way. But, I mean, like, hopefully this is just going to be the experiment year, and then, you know, teams will figure out, go from there, you know, but I'm just against it altogether. I mean, you're going to shift on the big guys, that's one thing, but shifting on, you know, guy batting 230, 210, it's just ridiculous, you know?
Well, I mean, I just think, and I was talking with Mike about it and Neil about it a little bit earlier. I mean, the game, and I'm not saying it's the worst thing that could happen, but the game's slowly getting away from guys that actually understand it on the field level. And so, you know, you get a situation, you're talking about it hurting the Yankees on a defensive side of the ball, it's because nothing's 100%. And, you know, you get these numbers, and these number geeks will tell you that it's, you know, we never said it was 100%. It's only 65% of the time that he does this. But the fact of the matter is sometimes a guy who's a dead full hitter hits the ball off the middle, or he hits the ball to the left side, or something happens. And
yeah,
you can't account for that if you have your fielders out of their normal position. I mean, if you have shortstop vacated, and a guy hits a bounding ball through shortstop, it's going to get through every single time. Whereas if you just played it straight up, it might not be that way, but that's the way the game's heading. And, probably 10 or 15 years from now, you're going to get the game to a level where somebody like myself is going to have to learn these metrics because I don't understand half of them. I don't care because if I say to Mike right now, so-and-so's hitting 240, Mike knows he's having a bad year. Now you get into a situation with the fielder-independent pitching, and you get into all these advanced things. And, you know, Mike and I have talked about it ad nauseum, and I'm not a fan of it. I don't think you're a fan of it, Mike, but you're not as hateful towards it as
I dabble.
I do dislike the analysis of it that way. I just don't have a problem with the shift because that's kind of like an end result. You look at all these different things. At the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of different ways to win a baseball game.
I'll be a hypocrite. I guarantee you I would put some kind of shift on if I had those numbers in front of me. The problem I have is how prevalent those numbers are becoming and controlling the way the game is played. I think the more you look at numbers to control baseball of all sports, the more you're getting yourself into trouble. Well, that's just how I feel. I'm not saying I'm right, and I am being a hypocrite saying I would probably shift if I had that. If somebody told me Mike DePalma's coming up and he hits the ball here 40% of the time, that's a lot. That's a lot of the time, and I might consider, you know what, let's shade our shortstop over there. But then you hit a ball through the four hole, and how am I supposed to play that to my pitcher? Sorry, I didn't have anybody there.
Let's just point out the fact that Nick just brought up. He said the two teams that lead the league in the shift are the Astros, the worst team in the American League, and the Yankees, who, let's be honest, are a couple games over 500 and have a $200-some-odd million payroll. So how much is it working to win games, right, Nick?
It's not paying off. It doesn't look like it's paying off really for the Yankees. I mean, like I said, I'm looking at it now defensively that they're, you know, it's costing them outs. I mean, if it's going to, in the end, I can have, like you said, like we're all saying, at the end of the year when all the data is collected, you look at them, you know, the bulk of it and say, okay, more outs were taken away. But I mean, I just remember Brian Roberts last week or 2 weeks ago, he was playing out of position because of the shift and he couldn't, you know, convert the double play. That to me is grounds right there for why he's shifting on this guy, you know, or why he's shifting in you know, period. And
remember
to the shift,
the,
I can understand
the
lefty
game?
Power hitters, but to the righty hitters with men on base, that just drives me crazy. I mean, that just, I can't take it, you know?
You remember the end of the Yankee game when we appreciate the call, Nick, by the way, as always.
All right, thank you, Nick.
You had due to make that great play,
yeah.
Right? It scored a 3-5-3 double play because they're shifting and there's David Wright. That's the stuff that concerns me. I know that's old school and I know it doesn't have any effect on anything.
That's a weird thing to be concerned about.
But you know what I'm saying? If I'm looking through a scorebook and I see a 3-5-3 double play, the first thing that crosses your mind is what?
Across the diamond.
You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that maybe concern's the wrong word. I guess it just bothers me on some level. Like,
yeah.
You got David Wright playing there. You got a third baseman who's taking the pivot now. And all these things that are going on. It's like, for what? Can't we just go back to the baseball we watched as kids? It was so fun.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is, it was about winning games.
Right.
And the two teams that Nick just mentioned, I don't know any of those guys. I mean, the freaking Astros stink. And any Yankee fan that wants to tell me they're not disappointed in a 27-24 start is a liar. So they're disappointed in what they're doing. So what is it really doing? How many times has the shift won a game for the Yankees? Has it gotten an out? Sure. Has it also cost them out? Sure. How many times do you see the shift? You're like, oh, I hit right into the shift. Well, they weren't shifting. He would have hit it right to the second baseman. So it would have been an out anyway. You know, like I always think of that. How many times did they, you know, they act like if the shift wasn't on, they just don't have a second baseman.
It bothers you more than you went on. You said it doesn't bother you at all. Look at you. You're getting fired.
No, it doesn't bother me. The idea
that
it doesn't bother
that.
Me. It doesn't. I don't think that it works as much as they think. But it doesn't bother me that they do it because they're doing it for the right reasons to win a baseball game. I just think it's going to be one of those things, and I think this will be the bellwether year where they judge it and say, well, yeah, maybe it really didn't really save us that many runs.
I agree with Neil, too, though, is the fact that...
Because you always agree with Neil, because you love the guy.
Because he's the smartest guy on the show. But it's got to be a certain naked feeling pitching, knowing that you don't have anybody on this side of the field. Like, you know, I remember playing wiffle ball as a kid, and we'd have enough guys, you'd pitch a ball, and you'd run over and try to cover the left side of the field.
Yeah.
It's like that. Like, you're expecting Neil to get on the mound, throw some pills in there, and know, hey, you know what, if I miss my spot by 2 inches, and this guy's a tenth of a second late, there's an automatic base hit if he hits it 15 miles.
Or you get those stupid broken bat hits
right.
That would have been a routine ground ball that wind up just quailing out into no man's land that a shortstop would normally just caught or fielded or whatever. You're going to get those. And there's nothing more frustrating than a bloop single or a ball that should have been caught or anything like that from the pitching perspective. But somehow we took our Mets talk, and we turned it into a talk about the shift.
Save the metrics.
Which is fine with me.
Yeah.
Now, before we take a break, I just want to – did you read my article today about the ERA?
I did not.
All right. I'm sure Neil didn't either because Neil doesn't read any of our articles. But,
I did.
So, Neil, what did you think? I mean, what frustrated me was I got into an argument about WHIP, about WHIP is a very super important stat, and I think it is a fantasy-driven stat. I do think that it is a good stat to look at, but it, to me, as a guy who follows baseball, and you would say it as a pitcher, to me, baseball comes down to – basically, just to the article, Danny, is baseball comes down to pressure situation. Can you get out of a bases-loaded jam by getting the guy to roll the ball over and throw a play? Can you get a guy on third base with no out? Can you get out of that jam and not let him score? Can you work your way through the middle of the order? Those are the situations. So the amount of guys that get on base, to me, if I see a guy with a high whip and a low ERA, I say that guy's a good pitcher. That guy's a guy who knows that I can pitch around this guy because I know I can get the next guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so to me, the bottom line, and I almost thought about putting like innings to me is a very important set that a pitcher can give you a lot of innings. That means that he's doing well, and it means he's saving your bullpen. But at the end of the day, ERA is the only stat that really matters. You can be a guy that's going to have a low ERA. You're going to have a guy that's a good pitcher. Now, what do you think? I mean, is there any other stat in pitching? I know people are discounting the win, and I don't think the win should be completely discounted because there are times when a guy pitches to a lead and does this and keeps his guy in the game and all the rest. But at the end of the day, ERA is the stat that matters with pitching.
I would agree with that. Almost – entirely. I mean, Ralph Kiner said that the most important stat to him was runs and RBIs for a hitter and the ERA for a
hitter. Now I've been told that RBIs mean nothing by people, by the stat favorite person. I mean, not like they're not important. They mean nothing.
Yeah, you're listening to idiots.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I'm not going to be the stick in the mud. I don't like that stuff, so we've covered it, and I don't want to bore everybody. But, when I look at a pitcher, and, we've had the discussion, too, even OPS to me, like, it was fine when it was just on-base percentage. And slugging was right next to it. I understood it just as well. Now I see OPS, and I'm kind of combining them in my head, wondering which part. It's 800, so which is which? Everything was fine to me 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I understood the game fine. I don't think I've ever been around someone that said to my face, you're a baseball idiot, because I don't follow this stuff. So when I saw on-base percentage, when I saw slugging, I was fine. When I saw how many hits a guy gave up, and I looked at his innings pitched, and I saw how many walks he had, I looked at each thing separately and independently of one another. I knew exactly what kind of pitcher I had just on a piece of paper. You didn't have to see him play.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, WHIP to me, I don't do fantasy. Frankly, I don't even look at it. I couldn't tell you what someone's WHIP is on the Cubs pitching staff right now, but I could tell you who's pitching well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how do I know who's pitching well? Samardzija is pitching phenomenally well, and he finally got his first win in San Fran over the weekend. How did you know he's pitching well? You look at his ERA.
Sub two.
I mean, now, just striking guys out, doing everything.
Neil, as a pitcher, what did you think of it? I mean, as a pitcher, you look back at your collegiate stats, high school stats, whatever. What was the most important stat to you? Could have been wins. I don't know.
I mean, it wasn't wins, and, I was never really a fan of the ERA because I never had a good one. But, I'd always come up with excuses to say, well, that should have been an out. If he makes the play there, if we're able to turn two, I'm out of the inning and that run shouldn't even count. So, ERA, as black and white as you think it can be, you've never, step inside a pitcher's mind for nine innings and see how they think about ERA, because there are a lot of times where it's like, a bloop hit, if you have a faster outfielder who can get to the ball and dive and catch it, guy loses it in the lights and it falls and it's not an error because he didn't touch it, but the, a guy who has sunglasses in center field would have caught it. So ERA, in my mind, can be just as wishy-washy. It's tough to say because, for me, I've been listening to you guys and I've been thinking about my own career and, to me, it's, do you get your tater tots ripped on the mound? And I'm talking about what is your opponent's slugging percentage against you? I don't know if they currently keep that, if they have opponent slugging percentage, but if you have a guy that's constantly giving up gappers, doubles, triples, home runs, that's not a good pitcher because they're getting a good look at your pitch and they're able to size it up and they're able to smash. But if you have a guy like myself who gives up little dribblers that no one can get to, a little bloop that no one can get to, these dinky singles that keep happening against you, Well, then you're a better pitcher. Guys are not on top of you. They're not reading you. They're not seeing the ball clearly. They just happen to get lucky. So if we can keep that stat, I would be personally happy.
Well, they do keep the stat. I mean, you can go to Baseball Reference and get that stat. But I think the general point you're making, and I agree with it, that there isn't really a stat, and I think that Danny will agree with it too, for a guy that follows baseball, there's not one stat you could point to tell whether a pitcher is good or not. Because you just have to watch it. It's an eyeball test. And there are going to be little duck farts here and there that they cost guys runs, and there's going to be that. I mean, I think maybe there isn't that one stat, and maybe it's just you have to watch a guy. And that's why I always loved C.C. Sabathia, you know, before the last year and a half, because I would watch him, and I would say, you know what this guy does? He'll give up three in the first, and he'll still last seven, and he'll give up three runs over seven. He's that's the type of pitcher I like. The guy that I could watch, look at John Lester last night, gives him a bases loaded, no-out jam, gets a double play, and gets a strikeout, and gets out of it. So it is kind of an eyeball test, and you could look at, you know, he gave up three runs over six innings. Well, you know what? He also danced around a lot of problems that weren't necessarily caused by him, and I think that a lot of it is the eyeball test. So maybe there isn't a specific stat you could always point to.
Well, I mean, I was going to say that. To me, ERA means a ton when I look at a starting pitcher stats. That shows, to Neil's point, you know, you give up a leadoff double, but let's say you give up six extra base hits in nine innings pitch, you know what I mean? You work out of some jams, you give up two earned runs. Yeah. To me, that's more of an impressive start than a guy who gives up 11 singles, you know what I mean, and kind of works his way around it or whatever. You give up extra base hits and you get out of those jams, ERA is a good barometer of what you're doing. I am a proponent of team error that I know some people have been talking about, because you talk about a ball like Neil mentioned, a ball that drops between the backpedaling second baseman and the right fielder that should be caught, goes in as a hit when it should have been caught. No one gets an error. Now, that runner is obviously charged to the pitcher if he comes on the score. I am a fan of saying, hey, you know what? The Cubs screwed up. That ball should have been caught. So that guy's an unearned run. Yeah. I am a fan of that, because that even makes ERA even more important, because now you get a feel for not so much the balls that drop in between the raindrops and they fall in somewhere. Now you get a feel for, hey, you know what? The Cubs screwed up. That ball fell in. That guy's an unearned run. Whatever.
Yeah.
Out of the bullpen, though, you get into a situation. I forget who it was a couple years ago for the Yankees. He gave up, like, a ton of hits. It was like a hit and a half an inning, and, you know, he was just kind of struggling around or whatever. He didn't yank by Girardi, and the guys were coming in and saving his tail. So his ERA, I forget who it was, but it was, like, 1.9. And you're looking at it, like, he's literally pitched 15 innings and given up, like, 24 hits.
Yeah.
How else am I supposed to believe he's a good pitcher? And that goes to what you're saying of the eye test. You watch a guy pitch. You know who your crappy pitchers are in the bullpen, and you know who you're going for.
Yeah.
But when I'm looking at stats and I want to know, how's Travis Wood doing? The first thing I look at is the ERA.
Yeah,
not the wins and losses, because the team stinks.
Yeah, not the wins and losses.
So the ERA is what I look at.
There's plenty of guys that strike out, a lot of guys that can't get wins or have low ERA. The only other thing, the only problem, and I didn't include in the article, that it skews the ERA, and it was geared towards relief pitchers, like you said, is if a guy has one outing as a relief pitcher and you're only going to throw 67 innings during the season, you got one outing where he pitched one inning and just gets pitchless, and it's, you know, you give up six runs, yeah, that's going to skew your ERA for the whole season. You look at a guy like Ryu out in L.A., he had that one ridiculously bad start. He pitched, you know, two innings, gave up seven runs. And you look at him, oh, he's got an ERA at three. But every other start, the guy's quality start, it kind of does skew. So that is one thing, you know, you have one bad start, one bad relief appearance, it can skew it. I think it happens less with pitchers because you're throwing 200 innings. But you get a guy, you know, you get a guy like a reliever, like, say, Trevor Rosenthal, and his ERA looks really high. He had a couple really bad outings, and the rest of the time he's been, you know, like that. So I do think none of the stats are completely unflawed. But I just think when I'm looking at a pitcher, I'm going to say, what's this guy's ERA? You could Jeff Samardzija. You did me, you know, look at this guy. He's got a ERA at 1.68. Wainwright, 1.67. These guys are giving up under two runs for nine innings. We're winning games, and that's what the game's all about. Four more runs to the opponent.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. Come back to Dude, Are You Serious? Courtesy of Neil Lynch. We've got 20 minutes left in the show. We'll be right back.
Mike, what is your deal, man?
Oh, come on, man. You've been riding me all day.
Mike, you're playing like Betty White out there.
That's not what your girlfriend said.
Oh. Baby.
Whoa.
Eat a snack. Better?
Better.
That hurts. You're not you when you're hungry. Snickers satisfies.
All right, we're back. TriStateSportsGuys.com. Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys and at TriStateSportsGuys. Everybody's favorite topic here, Neil, and I know Danny loves it the most. We call it Days. Due to you, serious. Neil's going to take us around the internet and give us some good stories to talk about. Neil, what do you got first? Kick us off with something good.
You know, we made a bet on Twitter that, you know, the NFL released their over-unders for each team, you know, the number of wins that they'll have in the regular season. They had the Giants at 7.5, which I just thought was preposterous. I think before this offseason I would have said that that's probably really realistic, but after all the moves that they made, both from free agency and the draft, I think it's no question they're going to have the over. You didn't think so. You were going to take a bet, and the bet is if they get over 7.5, you need to wear a Giants ugly sweater that I've already purchased. You have to wear it for New Year's and birthday, which is July. Have fun with that.
I know. I
and then if
you know it was July when you made that bet. It's kind of a jerk move by you.
And then if the Giants get less than 7.5, then I get to wear your severely stained Chad Pennington Jets jersey. And I have to wear that for on stage for 3 sets, stand-up comedy sets. So that's on camera with the Jets, Chad Pennington stained jersey. The reason I bring that up, well, because it needed to be brought up, first of all. But second of all, it segues to my first Do Dirty series, and that's that a Jets fan has bought the Mark Sanchez butt fumble jersey for a cool $820.
I thought that was extremely – I saw that article. I thought it was extremely low for that. You would think – I mean, that just shows you that Jets fans are generally pretty blue-collar and poor. But you would think that that type of memory would generate more than $822. And who sold it? Was it Sanchez that sold it, or the Jets, or did some equipment manager take it? Who sold? I didn't see who sold the jersey.
I don't know, but he's. I think he said that. Okay, so Jake Hendrickson, who lives in California, noticed the jersey was posted on the NFL auctions website last week, and you know, second realized he knew what it was, he had to have it. I think he said he's going to put it on his wall until they win a Super Bowl, or he can get enough money to put it in a rocket ship and shoot it into outer space. So I think
this guy's not
going to
get
right?
that kind of. I mean, look, you know I'm a Mark Sanchez guy, so this breaks my heart. I'm rooting for him to have some success in Philadelphia. I really am. I think that he got a bad rap. I don't think the guy's a great quarterback, but I don't think he's going to be remembered for the fumble and the Tebow mania thing, which wasn't his fault, and all the rest. This jackass ain't gonna send this thing into space. Let's cut to Brad Tack here, this jackass. So, and he's from California. Was he a transplanted Jet fan? Good Jet fan.
He's got an audit.
Yeah, the guy that bought it from Cali.
He's got $800 to send it to outer space.
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah, where's he going with it? He's got one of those model rockets where they put like hamsters up, like, you know, 700 feet, and then explodes over Cranberry Park. Yeah. You know what? The article, when I saw the headline, it frustrated me. I read the first paragraph of it, and it frustrated me enough to click off it. You know, everybody wants to crap on the Jets, always.
Not me, Mike.
Not you. Not Danny. He's on board. But you know what, Neil? I am confident. Although my birthday is July 3rd, I am confident I will not be rocking that ugly-ass wool sweater next July 3rd because the Giants are in for a tough season.
I asked if I could get it washed, the Chad Pennington jersey, and I guess the question, but, you know, I think I'll get more laughs out of the Pennington jersey than I would my own set, so I'm all for this bet.
Are you going to acknowledge, like, why you're wearing, I'm just wondering, because I've been to, you know, your comedy show, you dress nice, you like you do, you're a nice boy, so you dress nice. you're going to come rolling out there in a big-ass, I mean, it's big on me, and I'm bigger than you. So it's going to be a big mustard stain. You know, there's like caked on Knish potato on the left-hand side there. It's a gross Jets jersey. You're going to just roll onto the stage with that. You're going to have to kind of address it to the audience, don't you?
I feel like part of my comedy is that I don't address the obvious. And so I just think I let the audience run with that, let their imaginations run wild, let them see, you know. And if they are completely distracted by it and can't laugh, I think that it's almost Andy Kaufman-esque what that kind of performance is like. So to do it three times in a row, I mean, I might get a deal out of this. You might see me on Comedy Central after these three performances.
Well, what happens if you get picked up? Like, say there's a talent agent there from NBC. They say, well, we want to pick you up. You're the next King of Queens. Now you're gonna have to just rock that. That's gonna be your like go-to thing. That's the guy who wears the Chad Pennington stained shirt. What if that's your thing? What if that's like your Carrot Top like Gallagher like thing? Like your gimmick is I wear this weird looking Chad Pennington jersey.
I think I live the lie till I hit seven figs, and then I come clean in a book, a tell-all book, and then it's all good.
That's it. You're marching down the parade of heroes. What else you got?
Andre Blatch has a hookah shaped like an AK-47. Question number one, have you ever smoked from a hookah? There's nothing wrong with it. That's the first question. Number two, would you feel comfortable smoking a hookah shaped like an AK-47? And three, is this anything that Jason Kidd and the Brooklyn Nets should worry about?
I'll go off first. I've never smoked out of a hookah. If I did smoke out of a hookah, I guess I wouldn't really have a problem with what it was shaped like. I don't know.
Not at all. So it could be any shape.
Well, I mean, not... Yeah, no, I'm comfortable in myself. It could be any shape. I guess if I want to smoke out of a hookah and it's like a thing, whatever it is, I think I can handle it. I don't think it doesn't impact me. But the third thing is, look, Andre Blatch has had issues throughout his life. I mean, Andre Blatch is a guy who never were able to get because he had off the court issues. He's had issues at strip clubs. He's had issues really at every stage of his life. I don't think that Andre Blatch needs to be seen smoking out of a hookah in general, let alone out of a hookah that's shaped like an AK-47. Now, why don't you answer the three questions, Dan?
I've never smoked out of a hookah. I've been present for a hookah smoking, you know what you call it?
It's a Darien thing, I'm sure you
have. Not even a Darien.
No?
No, not even.
They have a hookah bar in New Haven that I've been to. It's just weird and annoying, and I just immediately left.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't have any desire to smoke out of one, period, regardless of what it's shaped like.
But if you were, would you... protest it because it's an AK-47, and I'm not a gun advocate.
I'm assuming, what do you call the part of the gun with the bullet from that? Is that the nozzle or something? What do you call that?
The barrel.
At the end of the barrel. That's what you're smoking out of. That would be a little off-putting.
Yeah.
Especially
it's,
as you mentioned
suicide.
With Andre Blatch's past with some things, you might think to yourself, maybe this really isn't a hookah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm about to play Russian roulette with myself.
Yeah.
I don't know. That might be odd. I'd rather smoke out of one. Like the one I saw had a big chamber and then a bunch of, like, hose-like things. That
yeah, like, very, like, Indian. Type
yeah.
Of, like, you
yeah.
know, it's got that little vibe to it. You think there's, like, a sitar in the back.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with people smoking out of hookahs, but I don't think the AK-47 wouldn't bother me, and I don't think I would partake.
But it just seems to go against the hookah smoking. I feel like that's, like, a
very peaceful, right?
It's like a very peaceful Hindu namaste type thing, and you're going AK-47. That seems a little off-putting. But the third question is, is that something they should be concerned about?
No.
I guess it goes with what Andre Blatch is.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, you know, you get some of these guys in all the sports that are off the field or off the court issues, whatever you want to call them. Maybe this is the least offensive that he's done.
Can I?
I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing.
Can I take over? I'm sorry, Neil, but I want to ask you a question. Take over due to you serious real quick. I want to talk about it. Maybe it's in later on, but Johnny Football's trip to Vegas has been, like, you know, widely panned, and why aren't you reading your playbook? I had no problem with him on and off weekend going to Las Vegas. It's like the thing I've been saying about Carlos Gomez and Jose Reyes. Like, that's his personality. This guy, it's like Gronk. It's like, you know, he was there taking photos of Gronk with his crazy hot girls. Like, he's not going to be Hitman. He's not going to be the nerdy guy that'll do, you know, just go read the playbook. And if you're going to, so whatever you do in your downtime is your downtime. To say that is, what about all these guys doing, you know, promotions, and they spend a weekend doing Dunkin' Donuts commercials? Are we supposed to complain about Eli Manning going doing Dunkin' Donuts commercials? What's really the difference? He's not studying his playbook when he's doing a Dunkin' Donut commercial. The guy's got his off time, he's got his off time. Nobody in the world can sit there and study a playbook every waking hour. So what he does in his off time is not a problem. I mean, Neil, am I wrong with that?
Yeah, I mean, I was good. I thought it would be a great, you know, a story for your false outrage segment that we used to have, in that, you know, people go a little bit overboard in thinking that, you know, whenever you see Johnny Manziel at a party, it's he's not – there are no pictures of him passed out with vomit all over himself. And there are no stories that come out of it like they did about Jeremy Shockey being where he drinks himself and he has to go to the hospital and stuff like that. I mean, this is a guy that likes to be in the party environment, in the party scene, but I don't know that he necessarily goes over the top or overboard with his partying to the point where he's, you know, incapacitated, you know. And so I think that's what people need to understand. I mean, the guy has gotten to where he is because of who he is. So to ask him to change now, you know, it's near impossible. I mean, the kid has that, you know, I hate to use the word swagger, but he has that confidence and that cockiness and arrogance about him. That's what makes him who he is and how he's able to play the game. He doesn't play scared or timid or afraid. So, you know, if the guy wants to go to Vegas and celebrate a Memorial Day weekend, you know, that's fine, but as long as he knows that, there are repercussions and there are consequences. If you're gonna go and do that, you got to walk the fine line. And I mean, as it turns out, the kid did bring his playbook. So I mean, he's still thinking about football even when he's on during his downtime.
Exactly. I mean, so say he didn't go to Vegas, Danny, and he just had a house party at his house. Whatever he was doing. It was, you know, Memorial Day weekend or whatever he's doing. What's the difference?
I tell you what I've learned about Johnny Manziel and watching everything he did at A&M and everything he's done since draft day and on draft day. This kid can't win with everybody no matter what he does. So if he became the film-watching, nerdy football player, you know, like the great Peyton Manning, people would say he's only doing that to appease everybody else.
Yeah, he's changing who
so,
he is and blah, blah, blah.
Short of winning a Super Bowl or becoming a playoff, you know, constant with the Cleveland Browns, I don't know what Johnny Manziel can do to calm everybody down. The other thing that I thought is people are in general envious of professional athletes. You know, we all want to be them. We all wish we knew what that was like or whatever. So the minute we see these guys doing something that doesn't involve honing their craft in their given sport, we tend to look at it, or the people start yelling and screaming from rooftops like, he should be in there studying film. This guy's batting 200 last 3 weeks. He should be taking batting practice till his hands fall off. And, like, you know, you forget they're human beings. Some of them have wives, kids, families, whatever, other things. Some of them give their time to charity, you know. And we don't crucify them for that. We crucify them for going to Vegas. Well, guess what? He just got a signing bonus. He's going to have money coming to him. He wants that, so he's 21 years old.
Yeah, right.
Like, I mean, you know, I'm all for guys being businesslike and all that stuff, but I don't forget, personally speaking, that guys have lives.
Yeah.
You can't play football 24 hours a day. It's probably not healthy for you.
I think it's a great point. What if the guy spend his weekend just on a retreat? You know what I mean? Like, what about, like, Team Tebow? Nobody complains. Like, he goes on retreats. He goes to Thailand or whatever.
Considered sure.
But that he's not studying his playbook.
Oh, exactly.
So what's the point?
There is
none. You can't make the point. You want to say that it's bad for his body, you know, like, but that's not the point. The point is, this guy said he was going to be studying his playbook. So on a Saturday night during the off season, he's supposed to not be doing anything. But like my point is, like if these guys are not doing Dunkin' Donuts commercials or, you know, Russell Wilson got a, you know, I don't know what it's even for. He's like in a barber and he's like getting his hair cut and he's, you know, but that's okay. That's not studying his playbook.
No, this is the power the NFL has as our biggest sport now. You know, I mean, it struck me at the time, as we know, I'm a big college hoops fan, and you watched at the NBA draft combine. Andrew Wiggins, Joel Embiid, Jabari Parker, none of them worked out. None of them worked out. All I saw was, and I watched some of the draft combine. That's what a loser I am. The NBA draft combine. It came across the crawl, that they weren't working out at the, you know, those top three picks. No, they talked about it with Fran Fraschilla and Jay Williams and those guys for 15 seconds, and that was it.
Yeah.
Because the NBA can't compare to the NFL in the grip it has on our society. So now here's Johnny Manziel, who's got some off-the-field stuff. Everybody, I think, is just kind of waiting around for the fall of Johnny Manziel, which I'm hoping it's the opposite of that. He is a hot dog. He's got all the things, the money fingers, everything he does. I'm hoping he blows Cleveland away.
Yeah.
Because if anybody deserves a winner, it's probably that city. I've been to Cleveland. It's not that bad.
No, I know. We had actually a couple of people from Cleveland on our baseball team, and they loved it. We had a couple guys. But I will say, I'm going to give you my prediction on Johnny Manziel. He's going to be Jake Plummer. He's going to have his moment where he looks like, you know, Jake the Snake. He escapes pressure and wins playoff games and does the rest. There's going to be times when, you know, I don't know that he's the guy that's going to get him over the top. But if he becomes Jake Plummer, that's fine with me. He justified it, the 22nd pick overall.
Well, the comparisons right now that you hear most frequently that I'm hearing are to Russell Wilson, and it's unfair. Russell's got a better team on.
It's just a stupid comparison. It's because they're short.
Well, yeah.
That's the only comparison. They're short, they're pretty normal, but they're not, I mean, a quarterback is all about decision-making and how they play the game. He's nothing like Russell Wilson.
No, I know.
Nothing.
But that's the comparison you're going to hear, and you hear some on the periphery talk about Drew Brees, because it's another guy that I think at the combine he was 5'11 and 3/4 or something. All the guy does is throw 5,000 yards.
He couldn't be any different.
No, I know. But people have to talk. That's why they have jobs on the airwaves and the TV that we listen to.
But that's why we're the number one podcast in the United States.
Because we're awesome. But I think we've talked enough about this. I mean, we know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, just in general about Manziel.
Yeah.
Let's just wait and see. I'm excited.
It's a very interesting story. Neil, what else you got, brother?
A woman who is not a large woman by any means, ate 2 72-ounce steaks in less than 15 minutes. A, do you think you can do that? And B, is this a woman that you think you could embrace if it were your daughter? Is this something that your daughter, do you think she can pull off come eating age?
Well, to answer the idea of this, the first thing I thought of was The Great Outdoors, the movie John Candy, where he ate the old 96er and beat the fast. And so I'm thinking, that's a 96er. This girl ate 144 ounces of meat, which is insane. But could I do it? Not even a remote chance. I couldn't eat one of them. I just can't. I'm not a thin guy, but I can't do that. I just can't sit there and eat that much. But would I – I don't – my thing with my daughter, my daughter Jameson, God bless her soul, she's a bulldog. She's a little bit of – we call the ice box, she's a little bit of a tomboy, and she likes to scrap. But I don't know that she – I mean, I've seen her eat 6 little power bar things in a row. I don't think she's that kind of eater. I don't see competitive eating in her future. So I don't know, but I would embrace it. God, if she could do that, I would embrace it because that makes her happy and she can make some money. I mean, these guys make good scratch. Jimmy Chestnut or whatever that guy's name is. Kenny Chestnut, what's his name?
Kenny Chesney?
No, the
Joey Chestnut
guy. I God bless her. If you can make some scratch doing that, go ahead and eat. Well,
yeah, I mean, unlike you, I am a thin guy.
Yeah.
I
can base him by crazy.
Absolutely. And I could not do that.
No way. You ate 172-ounce steak?
No. I've eaten, I think, up at the casino, I've eaten like a 18-ounce quarter ounce or something, but
I've seen. Just quick story before Neil gives one last one. I've seen Eddie Marini, who owns a couple of the businesses that sponsor us. We went to Dan Marino Steakhouse out in Vegas. The guy ate a 32-ounce steak. The lady came around, he wanted to eat dessert. He goes, "Yeah, I'll have another one of those." I swear to God, he ate another one, and then he had a little bit of cake. All right, Neil, you got 60 seconds. You got one quick one.
I think it's the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater became the first school in NCAA history to win a football, basketball, and baseball championship in the same year. Would you rather go to that school or Florida State University?
Oh, I'd rather go to the high school. That's a cool thing to do. It's college. I mean, college, that's what I mean. I'd rather go to the college that can, you know, rock out three schools. But go to Florida State. Talent there, female-wise, is pretty thick.
It's unbelievable. I was just going to say, it's an unbelievable.
We're going to have to take this to bonus time to break this down.
Yeah, mean, the,
we're gonna. You gotta listen. If you're listening live, we're gonna get some bonus time.
The women at Bill Campbell Stadium, they put a pin.
Well, we had the girl. Remember the girl, what was the girl's name? She became like an internet with a cowboy hat on. Like,
wasn't that the one that farmed that bubble with? Because she had to work for the
same job.
Was it Sterner or something?
Yeah, it was something like that. Neil, you probably
Jen
know
something.
That. Sturger?
Jen Sturger.
No, what was her name?
Sturger.
Jen Sturger.
Yeah, she's a champion.
Yeah, she, I mean, you look at some of these girls on first date. I mean, I guess they are pretty fantastic.
Are we talking about just going to school there or playing one of those three sports there?
Yeah, would define this question a little bit more, Neil. I mean, you're talking about playing a sport there. If you're, say you're playing one of the sports that didn't win those three national championships. So you're playing
my thought process was, all right, you are on the football team, you're on the basketball team, you're on the baseball team, you win all those championships at UW-Whitewater versus you go to the top party school in the United States and you're a walk-on in one of the teams.
I'm thinking of it as like talking to somebody at the bar. What's a better story? Playing football at Florida State? I might be changing my tune.
I think
football at Florida State is probably better.
Yeah. I mean, you get the opportunity to go play against the best. I mean,
here's
some of the best players you're going to see in all those three sports, even basketball, right there, don't you?
Here's the thing, though. I played baseball at Johns Hopkins as a good deal. And you kind of – I'm sure, Neil, you have the same thing. You say, I play college baseball. You say Johns Hopkins. And they think you're kind of like a nerd, and that was not a good school. And you say, well, you know, we went to a couple of NCAA tournaments. They've been to the finals before. You know, it's a legit program. To have that in your back pocket as far as, like, saying, well, you know, when I was there, we won three national championships, that's kind of a cool story, too. So to make, like, a little justification, I don't think it's a crazy question, but bottom line is, if you could say you played and dressed at Florida State.
Okay. I mean, would you rather? I can't use Hopkins because you guys went there, so you have a certain affinity for it. But would you rather have won a D3 baseball championship at Wisconsin Whitewater, or have played 4 years in the ACC for Florida State?
I think when you put it at that, I think winning that championship. I can remember my senior year with a one seed, we're ranked like fourth in the country. To have that moment, like as an athlete. How could you not rather have three national championships than just being a crappy player on a good team?
Well, no, I'm not saying crappy. I'm saying you could have played there. Played.
Even if you played there, you win a national championship.
No, but I'm saying you would have been there, played the ACC caliber of baseball, played at that school. Big-time baseball. I mean, that's them and
I get that. But as the way Neil puts it, playing off as an athlete, how could you not want to have the three?
He's saying
I'm back on board with I want the UW Whitewater.
One of the guys at Whitewater played on all three.
Oh, he's asking us.
Would we rather?
Yeah.
No, I'd rather play that for you.
So you don't? You're not a real athlete.
I wouldn't play football, basketball there.
But you play baseball. Play baseball, you have a nice little solid career, you never get drafted. You'd rather play baseball at FSU than to have three rings or anything.
Absolutely.
Neil, what do you think? What's your opinion on it? I would give anything to have won a national championship at South Africa.
I mean, outside of maybe Wisconsin, I don't know that story is going to fly with anyone. I mean, it's that's cool, that's nice. You know, I just don't know that it has the same kind of punching power as, I was on the practice squad for like a, you know, championship team or in the ACC, or like I played against Cam Newton when he was at Auburn or something like that. You know, there's a certain weight that a lot of these, that the Division I schools, more recognizable schools in the bigger conferences carry. You know, if you have a friend, I have a friend who played D1 football at Rutgers, and he told me about, you know, playing against the U. I mean, and seeing like Shockey in person. That's nuts. So for me, as impressive as it would be to be on the football, basketball, and baseball championship teams at Whitewater, I got to go with, you know, I suited up and was on the same field or rink or court as blah, blah, blah.
Well, here, let me just bring up a big quick point, because my former co-host, Osama Delwahab, he played at Wake Forest, pitched at Wake Forest, transferred to Johns Hopkins. He faced J.D. Drew, which is a great story, and it's probably a story he tells more and gets a better reaction than anything he did at Johns Hopkins. and this guy is, you know, fifth all time in conference history hitting, or whatever he is, you know, great career at Johns Hopkins. I think
Hall
that he's a better guy to ask the question. So would he have rather won a national championship at Johns Hopkins and traded in his story about facing J.D. Drew? And
that's tough, though, because I think what you're doing is you're thinking about all the experience you had. I mean, the guys you knew, the relationship you forged while you're there. I would bet you anything. If we talked to the 18-year-old Mike Paul, who said, somebody comes down and goes, you're going to go to Hopkins and win a national championship, or you're going to go to FSU. Now, I remember playing with you. I think you would have, in a second, said, you know what, I want to go play against those the best guys in one of the top conferences in the country.
If I played at FSU, I'd be playing in the major leagues. I wouldn't be doing the show yet.
Well,
I'd be playing center field for the Mets right now.
Yeah.
Sorry, Juan Lagares.
Right.
I'd be roaming center field at City Field.
Be that as it may, I think you would have taken that chance. And I think all three of us as former athletes would, yes, you would take the opportunity to try yourself and try your hand at playing against the best competition you could, even if someone could tell you with foresight you're never going to win anything. Just the cachet of I played baseball at FSU. I mean, you don't want to go be a scrub at
FSU. I'm just thinking on your deathbed, what's a better thing? Tip stories aside, sitting on your deathbed, you look up at, you know, the ceiling as you're taking your last breath. Is a national championship in three sports better than playing at FSU against the litany of NFL players? I'm taking the national championships. I'm on an island. I'm taking the national championships.
Yep,
I'm taking my ring.
I'm going to dip with you on that.
Yeah, you're the winner. All right, Neil. You got anything? We're already recorded time. You got anything else, or you just want to shut it down? What do you want to do, brother?
Well, I just had the one last one, which was that Charlie Whitehurst arm wrestled a punter to keep his number and lost. Now, first of all, all right, so he gives up the number, but shouldn't he, because he lost the punter, have to wear, like, the number zero or a really bad number?
Here's the thing. I read this story, and I don't have a problem with that at all. Punters have nothing else to do but lift weights. They're in this great facility all day. They go out and punt for half an hour. I remember that punter for the Jets, and I got to look up his name a couple years ago. I mean, the guy was jacked. I mean, like, you know, on special teams, this guy was like a player, like he would drive people to the ground. I think a punter should be lifting weights. That's what else they do. They should be arm wrestling.
Yeah, that could be a little embarrassing, though.
I agree
with you.
It's a little bit embarrassing, but I bet you that same punter would probably out arm wrestle all the cornerbacks on the team.
Yeah.
Most of the wide receivers. And I bet you he'll get into some other linebackers and safeties.
I'll tell you something that's actually a true story. My buddy that went to Clemson, Charlie Whitehurst played, went down there, saw Charlie Whitehurst actually playing the game at that foul. He's a good college quarterback. You know,
he hasn't
done that much as a pro or whatever. But in a drunken weekend haze for you Met fans, I reverted to calling him Wally Whitehurst.
Remember Wally Whitehurst?
All weekend. Really pitcher extraordinaire, Wally Whitehurst.
Of course.
That was, we actually met Jeff Baker at a pool table. In a bar, said, how you doing? You know, just a drunken idiot. I don't even remember. My buddy had to tell me we met Jeff Baker last night. But I did. I called. So every time I see Charlie Whitehurst now with that crazy hair and everything, the mullet, he works and everything, I just think of Wally Whitehurst. That's a pointless story that I just never tell you for no reason. But
it really ties the whole story together.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's what I did. When are we going to get into my Robinson Cano stuff for just 3 seconds, can we?
Yeah, let's get right into it.
Okay, I'm watching the Yankees the other day. They're in Chicago playing the White Sox. And Adam Eaton, who's one of my favorite players, comes up to the dish. And John Flaherty and Michael Kay started talking about a little story about Canerco and Adam Dunn pulling Adam Eaton aside and telling him, you know, this playing with your hair on fire kind of mentality is just not going to work. You're too good of a player. You're that leadoff horse. You're an outstanding outfielder. We need you in the lineup, right? So Michael Kay then brings up Robinson Cano, who Flaherty was so clear all those years couldn't stand the way Cano would not hustle and stuff. But he couldn't say anything because he didn't want to upset the Yankees. But he just let loose. And I don't know if you're the one who witnessed this. I know you're a Mets fan.
No.
So Flaherty was talking about how disgusted he was, literal word to you, disgusted, in watching Robinson Cano. So Kay said he's had the discussion with Jeter, who Jeter said, you know, I pulled him aside and said, we need you in the lineup. So don't get yourself hurt on that 1 in 1,000 chance that you're going to beat out of, you know, rolling ground ball to second base or whatever. So you know I love Hustle. You know I never liked the way Cano played, and I still don't like the way he plays. I see him on the MLB Network or something. But Flaherty said, all I was ever asking for was to make it look like you're hustling down the line. Because, you know, Cano would go out of his way to jog, and it was disgusting. But what I'm getting at is I turned a little bit of a corner saying, I'm not looking for him to run down the line like Pete Rose or Adam Eaton, but you don't need to run and make it so clear to the 30, 40,000 people in attendance that paid to come see you play that you're putting forth almost zero effort. You could at least make it look like 60, 70%. And then, you know what, because you mentioned a couple weeks ago, like, you know, he plays in 161 games a year, and that's true. And, you know, of course, now, especially with the money he's making, you want him in the lineup every day. But you don't have to look like a bum running the first, do you? So I turned a little of the corner. I don't need to see him run down the first like Jeter would or like, you know, Pete Rose knows those, you know, great clips you can watch of Pete running down the first on a walk like a lion's chasing or something. But I guess I don't need to see Cano run 1,000 miles an hour, but just make it look professional. That's all Flaherty was saying. Now, Flaherty was just below average big league ball player, but his point rings true for me. At least look presentable. I mean, is that a better way to look at it opposed to my hard line on I expect to see you flat out flying down the line? I mean, he's making $250 million now to play in Seattle, and obviously they want him in the lineup, but you don't have to look like a clown running down there, do you?
I just think it's just a nitpicky thing either way.
Why? I mean, don't I have a certain right, if I'm paying for a ticket, to see a product, like see that? You've said always, you go, they're entertaining you.
Yeah.
Don't I have a right to see them at least, like, try?
A guy, so you're saying you don't care if he doesn't bust it down the line.
But make it look like there's some effort by
it.
He never did.
It doesn't entertain you. A guy has.
Not you, but but if there's 40,000 people in the stands, they might have 40,000 different views on what entertainment.
Well, but you're asking me my opinion.
Yeah, you don't care. I'm not bringing it up to see if you necessarily care. I'm saying I turned a corner, a slight little corner, saying I agree more with Flaherty's theory than my theory of the way I was able to play.
Flaherty's theory is just as
why
because,
is that?
Because who the hell goes to a game? $80 to a baseball game, and what you're going to take away was, you know what? There was home runs. There was a guy throwing 95. There was great plays in the field. You know what I really like? The fact that Robinson Cano on a routine ground ball to shortstop kind of didn't really lag it. I like that. That's something I'm going to really be like, wow, I'm glad I paid $80 to watch Robinson Cano run slightly harder down the first base.
But I never said that was my takeaway.
You said it made you like it more. What of the 40,000 people are going to take that away?
I'm not talking for anyone but myself.
Well, I'm just saying, I do understand it, but it still doesn't make any sense. If I pay my $80 and I watch a great game, do I say that $80 is a waste of money because Robinson Cano didn't just kind of give me, as a paying fan, the idea that he was kind of hustling?
Well, no. First of all, your argument is all I'm saying. It's a fact. I'm arguing my opinion.
So if your opinion doesn't make any sense.
How does it not make sense?
How does it make sense?
How does it not make sense? What I'm saying is, when I see Robinson Cano run the first, it's disgusting, and it stands out to me. And I'm not the only one that thinks it. There's John Flaherty saying that he thought it.
Yeah.
So clearly, I would say we can't – well, he's better than I am.
Okay.
So he can't be – he and I can't be the only two that think that.
Well, I just disagree with that whole thing. I disagree with that as much as I disagree with the statistician people.
That's fine. I'm not trying to get anybody to agree with me. I was bringing up a little story to just say, like, you know, I'm watching a play, and I was always expecting, and I was always taught to run.
I was a guy, and Neil attested, I hustled all the time.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that everybody needs to hustle. I just need personal.
Oh,
I don't give a crap if anybody hustles. But, Neil, can you be the deciding factor that I'm right and Danny's wrong?
He's not going to decide anything. It's going to be his opinion, and all that. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I was sidetracked. I was distracted a little bit. You guys were arguing about Cano or no?
Yeah, maybe we're not going to go to Neil for an argument to decide the thing. I just don't I don't understand that. I don't understand your opinion.
You do understand it. You don't agree with it. You get it because you know me. You don't agree with it, but you understand it. You're misspeaking. I'm simply saying when I watch a ball game, it's nice to see a guy hustle. That's why Adam Eaton stands out to me.
That's my opinion.
I'm not saying everybody has to play that way. I'm simply saying when I see it, I notice it and go, you know what? It's a shame that that's the exception and not the rule. Because when our fathers were growing up, that's the way the game was played. I understand things change, All
well, he had Ernie Banks, and he said the guy's lollygagged it back, and Ernie Banks said.
Right. But, I mean, I don't remember hearing stories about that growing up from, like, my grandpa or something.
Because those guys didn't care.
Who didn't care? The players?
No, your grandpa wasn't sitting there watching a baseball game overanalyzing how hard a guy ran down the first base.
He's gone now. You should hear him tell a Tony Lazzari story. I mean, he'll tell you stories about him and Rizzuto, those guys. You saw Lou Gehrig play, and guys that played, like, their back ends were on fire. All I'm saying is, I'm not standing here stating a fact that everybody needs to do things the way I want to do it, but when I watch Robinson Cano play, it's disgusting to me. I don't care if you agree with it or not, but you do understand it. You said, I don't understand what you're saying. You get wholeheartedly what I'm saying. You disagree with me, which is fine. But it changed my thinking, and I was just curious to get the opinion of you guys, not to have you guys say that I'm wrong, because I'm not. It's my opinion. I'm not telling you Robinson Cano's not a good player.
Yeah.
It's my opinion of watching him play. Yeah. And my expectation was, along the lines of what Flaherty said when I started to think about it, was it wasn't that I needed Cano to run down the line as fast as he could every time. I know how great he is. I know you want him in the line. The Yankees did just like Seattle does. But he goes out of his way to load. That's the problem I have. He goes out of his way, which is such a shame, because I would have a really hard time watching, like, if you had gotten to the big league, watching you run the first like that, I'd be like, boy, that's not cool. And, you know, we get away from it. And I get attacked for it by people, not here, but from people over the years, for saying, like, there's kids watching the game.
Yeah.
There's kids watching the game. And like we did when we were kids, emulating a stance or a windup, maybe Neil emulated somebody's windup or something like that. You're watching these kids. And when you set that as the bar, that this is how you can hustle, and then you'll hear Major League Baseball talk about, we're trying to get into inner cities, we're trying to get out in the country and grow the game. They talk about falling behind in baseball. And all I'm saying is maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe these guys see this and go, you know what, this is how you play the game. That's how you play the game when you're as good as Cano or Griffey or something
yeah.
like that. That's not how your kids should be playing the game.
Oh,
and you wouldn't let them play that
I would never
that's
let
That's different
kids play
than Cano. I understand that. I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm saying that's how I feel when I watch the game. Watching Cano for the last, how many years would be like eight?
Probably, yeah.
It's disgusting to me because it's like you have as much talent as arguably anybody on earth, and this is how you play the game. It bothers me.
I just think that your argument tonight, I have more of a problem with than the argument that the guy doesn't hustle. Because to me, the reason you hustle is maybe the guy bobbles the ball. Maybe the throw's a little off and the guy comes off the bag and has to come back to it. And so running a little bit harder just for the sake of I'm going to run hard doesn't change any of that.
No.
So that's why I don't understand how John Flaherty's argument changed your view of anything or even made you either I agree with you. And part of the beauty of baseball is that there are the Adam Eaton's of the world, and if you're a kid, you might emulate Adam Eaton or Pete Rose or whoever, or you could emulate Reggie Jackson as a showboat or Carlos Gomez or Robinson Cano, and that's the guy you emulate. And I emulated the hustlers, but I don't have a problem with the lollygaggers.
That's fine. That's the only difference.
But I don't understand how this argument changed anything because at the end of the day, the reason you hustle is because of that kid, because maybe this guy bobbles the ball. So you just acting like you're running a little hard but not really running harder isn't going to get you on base because of an error.
What affected it was Kay discussing a conversation he had with Jeter, who I have the utmost respect for, and discussing something that, you know, I probably would have never heard if I wasn't watching a White Sox broadcast with the Yankees, because how often do you hear stuff about the White Sox?
Yeah.
But Paul Konerko is a guy I've always liked.
Yeah.
Paul Konerko never had speed. He was never going to be confused with Maury Wills, but he played right. He played the right way. And he pulled Eaton aside, him and Jeter, a guaranteed Hall of Famer and a guy who's on that fringe, a couple really good ball players going, pull it back a little bit. That's more of what I'm getting at. And Flaherty was going along the lines of Konerko and Jeter and those guys. That's what they want to see. Just show the effort. You don't have to run like your hair's on fire. But watching Cano, and I think I said on the show last week, he was in Seattle a few weeks ago. He hits a bounding ground ball to the second baseman's left, goes over, kicks it up, comes up on his chest, goes over to his left. Cano's running with his head down, like he's jogging.
Yeah.
And by the time he realized that this guy had moved the ball, he tried to turn it on, but he's not exactly fast, and he gets thrown out by about a half a step. Those are the plays where if he's not running 20 miles an hour, to your question, what's the difference between him not running all out and 30% opposed to 60%?
Yeah.
If he's running 75%, which is what Flaherty was kind of proposing, he'd be safe. He'd be on an E4 in Seattle to have a base runner. That's what I'm saying. Those things affect the game. Konerko's argument with Eaton was, why do it on a play? Why run 100% every time? when it's only going to affect it 1 out of 1,000 plays. Now, maybe that was the 1 out of 1,000 play for him.
Yeah.
Maybe it was. But this dude, when he was with the Yankees and he hit a ball in the gap, he was hitting second base looking to go to three every time. So
yeah.
He knew the argument of time and space of where the ball was versus how much time he had to get the play. You don't want him hurt. You don't want him out of the lineup. I get all that. But for me, and that's all I'm saying, I'm not trying to convert it, but I was just bringing up the point of conversation, was it's nice to see a guy who plays right,
yeah,
in my mind.
So
Adam Eaton does that.
So Derek Jeter is the guy you just mentioned.
Right.
The first series of this baseball season, he had a ball to right field that he thought was gone, that he jogged on.
Right.
And had to break it to second base on a bang-bang play. It happened to be safe. He plays the game the right way? Why did he jog out of the box?
Are you going to bring up one play?
Well, it's happened. You think that's the only time? So that's the only time Derek Jeter did that.
Would you argue that Derek Jeter played the right way?
I think he does play the right way, but everybody lowered at some point. This guy thought he had a home run. You don't think Derek Jeter's ever just jogged a home run out of the box? Of course he did. If he didn't, then he wouldn't have done that in the first series of the season.
Well, I'm sure he has. I'm just saying I don't remember it.
So he decided in the first season of his last season of his career, he was going to start doing it?
Did I say at any point here that I'm citing guys that hustle on?
You said he played the game the right way.
He does play the game the right way.
Why do you respect him if he did that? You just said you hate that.
Because he hits routine ground balls to short and he runs them out.
Sometimes.
Come on. You want to get into an argument right now? That is a 100% foolproof every second. I don't have any arguments like that. I don't have one where I can prove to you every time I'm right.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, you know Jeter plays hard. Neil knows Jeter plays hard. I know he plays hard. You know Adam Eaton plays hard. You know the guy. You sit here and pretend as though you don't know.
I think that people over-exaggerate how much Robin is going to allow again.
I don't think so at all.
Oh, I think so.
I disagree wholeheartedly because I think John Flaherty was proof in the pudding. Had he been able to say it for the last X amount of years, and we can sit here and say he wasn't good because he wasn't a good big league ball player, but he watched him. He knows what it takes to get to the big leagues and play there. He just doesn't have Cano's ability. But it bothered him. And I would guarantee you there's players it does bother, and I'll guarantee you there's players that don't care. I'll guarantee there's guys in the Brewers that go, Carlos Gomez is the best thing since canceled pockets because he's so good. And that's fine. I'm saying for me, Derek Jeter, how many times in 20 years have I seen him not hustle? I guarantee he's done it, but 99% of the time he hustles, and you could never make that argument for Cano, which is probably my original argument was.
Yeah.
Cano almost never hustled a ball out in the infield. He almost never had any purpose in being out on the field unless he got a base hit. Like, he didn't show you anything where you go, that's a baseball player, in my mind.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and say he's not good. I never have said that. Have I ever said that?
No, you never have.
He's a great ball player.
Yeah.
It would be nice for me, and maybe it goes back to some of the envious stuff I was mentioning before in regards to Manziel. If I had his ability, I look at it like, you know what, I would hustle. Maybe I wouldn't hustle every second of every play because they're paying me $25 million and I don't want to get hurt and be out of lineup. But I would look better playing the game on a 4-3 putout than Robinson Cano.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't prove anything. It doesn't make anything. That and a dollar will get me a cup of coffee. That's all I'm saying, though, is I would look better than he does doing some of the things he does. And it is gross to me. It doesn't bother Joe Girardi. So, obviously, I mean, maybe I'm in the minority, but I don't think I am. I think there's a lot of fans out there, probably especially in that over 50 crew, that are going, this isn't the stuff we saw. Now, Ernie Banks said guys didn't hustle. Maybe it was like a Jeter thing where Banks is, you know, going, I saw plenty of guys not hustle 5 times out of 1,000, but I remember them.
Well, I just think that back in Ernie Banks' day, every game wasn't on TV,
right?
And we didn't see it. So if you went to go see a ball game, you were watching the play being made, and you weren't watching the runner how they ran.
Well, that's probably true. But what I can't do is give you things that are right every single time. Jeter, if you don't know Jeter doesn't hustle, then you never watch the play.
I watch a lot of the.
That's what I'm saying.
But it's happened more than once.
Did I ever say it didn't? I'm saying he hustles so much of the time.
Yeah.
Maybe he was injured. That would make more sense.
First week of the season, he wasn't injured.
He just wanted the lolly guy. I don't know that.
He thought it was gone. He thought he had his moment.
No,
week of the season.
No. I remember the play, but I'm just saying. Maybe there were times in his career where someone was bothered. But I don't think he's the guy that loafs around.
Neil, comments?
I mean, what bothers me, I mean, I don't understand. I guess I just don't understand Dan's kind of, it sounds borderline obsessive right now. Like, you know, if that's the kind of ball player that Cano wants to be, then so be it. You know, I mean, I could see if you were a Mariners fan or you're a Yankees fan, you're like, this guy is losing his games. But in terms of being just a general baseball fan, yeah, it sucks. It's a waste of talent, and you know he could have been one of the greats of all time. But you know the fact that he has this malaise about him, it's definitely detrimental to the team and to his own personal status. But you know, I don't know that it bothers me that much. It just doesn't. I don't know if it's because, you know, he's kind of resigned himself to be that person. You know, I can understand if he's like he's having personal problems or it's just a rough patch. I mean, this is his entire career has been like this, so he's not going to change. So, you know, arguing over it's not going to do us any good. The one thing that does bother me the most about him is not running out ground balls or close plays or anything like that. It's him taking like half an hour to throw that ball to first. And I pray for the day when someone just gets sneaky quick that he doesn't know about and beats it out, because it's going to be a highlight for this century.
Well, I agree. I mean, but part of me is that's the reason why he's a good fielder, because he's that relaxed. And our college coaches would say we should encourage us to catch the ball with one hand, because the one-handed game, and you tense up when you catch the ball with two hands and all the rest. And now we have the big gloves. There's no real reason to have a second hand behind the ball. So I think that maybe that helps them. My thing, the problem I have with Dan's argument in general, and his original argument, more so than the argument brought up today, was that sentiment, your sentiment, is really at the core of what drove Robinson Cano to Seattle. It really is, because the Yankee fans never embraced him, and the Yankee organization never embraced him, even though he was their best player for half a decade. And the Yankee organization never came out and defended him as the fact that this guy was a superstar, and the Yankee fans badmouthed him time after time. And now, if they had not, I really think if they had embraced him as they embraced Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera and Jorge freaking Posada or Tino Martinez and these guys, if they had embraced it like that and really made him feel like you are everything to us, he would have re-signed with the Yankees, and they'd be better this year, next year, the year after that, and for the next 5 seasons, if it wasn't the 10 seasons, because they had Robinson Cano. But you got to play the game the right way, so he's going to go off to Seattle and hit 330, and you've got Brian Roberts playing second base. So I hope the Yankee fans are happy. Guys, if Brian Roberts plays the game the right way, he just stinks at baseball.
Well, I mean, I never said Brian Roberts was any better than Robinson Cano, and I never thought that he would get out of the Yankees' grasp, but he did. Maybe they were tired.
You don't think the Yankee fans and the organization, like Flaherty and the rest, they couldn't get past the fact that he
was. No, that's why. I mean, I can't talk for a Yankee fan. All I can do is tell you that's what bothers me about Starlin Castro. And it has cost the Cubs at points, because regardless of what you want to tell me or what anybody else wants to tell me, thinks I'm wrong. The fact of the matter is that when you play lethargic at times, it can hurt you more often than it helps you. That's as close to a fact as my opinion can get. And Starlin Castro does a lot of boneheaded things. And he is like Robinson Cano with about a quarter of the ability.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he is, okay? And you see it now with Junior Lake. You see him make mistakes because he doesn't have his head in the game. And they talk about it. Cano made a lot of stupid mistakes playing with the Yankees. And fans in New York, everybody wants to talk about, you know, it's a blue-collar city and the fans are hard and everything. They don't want to see that. So that makes me think, doesn't help me at all in this discussion, but I'm not alone. I'm not a fan watching the Yankees.
But the Yankee fans, they were happy, almost happy to see him go.
Yeah.
They almost were. All of them were like, let him go. Like, we're not paying him this money. All of them. When I came out and said that it was stupid for the Yankees to do it, I wrote an article about it, I got killed by Yankee fans. And I'm going to tell you right now, the Yankees will be a better team with Robinson Cano today. They'll be a better team.
There's no question.
So you go ahead. You're going to watch a guy hustle to first base, but you're not going to win as many baseball games. In my opinion, I'd rather win more baseball games. The thing that's hard with this argument is I play the game, and I appreciate the game the way you play it. But that doesn't mean that I don't think everybody necessarily needs to play the game like I play the game. I don't think there is a right or wrong way to play the game, because you know what? Robinson Cano is better than me, and if anything has changed, I just think that everything in life is like that, where you change one little thing, it could change your whole trajectory for everything.
You know what will happen? you know what happened? He'll run a ball out the first base and stuff. But you see the guy, Casilla the other day with the Giants. I know he's a pitcher, but he blows his hamstring out by running a ground ball out the first base. Right?
But look,
at some point, Robinson Cano will he'll hit a bounding ball somewhere that he thinks he can beat out. And that's the only time Robinson runs, when Robinson thinks Robinson can get to the base. Okay? He'll bust it. He'll injure something. And then people will try to put a guy like me over the flames and you know, burn me to death because they'll say, like, see what happened? See what happened? But that doesn't mean that that's not a proper way to play the game.
Look at Bryce Harper. Everybody loves
I love watching Bryce Harper play.
He can't stay healthy for a single season in his own career.
I'm saying that's what Flaherty said, and I think my argument is that's I guess that's how I think or how I thought of Cano. Like, I don't need him to run every time on the first as hard as he can, but at least make it look professional. That's what you're getting paid for. You're getting paid to be a professional baseball player, and he's getting paid to produce runs at the ballpark, bat 330, like you said, or whatever. But when I watch a guy like Harper play, and I know that at the time when he ran into the fence out of Dodger Stadium, Davey Johnson was the manager at the time, pulled him tight and said, hey, listen, dude, we can't continue to have this. You're a guy that needs to be a 2-3-4-5 hitter for us or whatever. Can't have you out of the line.
That's the reason they got him back from behind the plate. He was a catcher.
Right.
They don't get hurt. And now he gets hurt more in the outfield than he would have ever done as a catcher.
What Adam Eaton, and maybe this serves your point, what Adam Eaton told Canerico and Dunn, according to the story, was, it's too difficult for me to change the way I play. It's the only way I know how to play. Been playing this way since I was in high school, college, whatever. So maybe that proves your point. Maybe this is just in Cano's DNA. He plays this way. I personally think he plays this way because he's allowed to get away with it because of how good he is. You can't be a fringe big league player.
Right. Well, you'd be Jordani Valsky.
Yeah, you can't be Ryan Kalish with the Cubs because he runs like he's got someplace to be because he has to. He has to leave some footprint or fingerprint on the game when he plays in it because he's not good enough to do the things Cano does. I just wish Cano, as great as he is, and he is so fun to watch hit, and he's such an unbelievable defensive second baseman. I guess I just wish, like, I wish he would just do more of the hustle things to make himself look better, but he doesn't care. Maybe people in Seattle don't care.
Can I concede one point? If I played with Robinson Cano, like
it would bother.
It would bother.
Absolutely.
But as a fan, I don't care.
That's fine.
I don't care if I'm in the front office. It wouldn't bother me. If I played as a player with him, it would bother me. I've had guys that are lackadaisical.
Well, I answer this. It wouldn't bother me in the front office. It certainly wouldn't bother me as an owner, because I'm the one cutting the checks to these guys. Would it bother you as a manager? I mean, you're watching that as a manager. And that's why when we had the discussion, I said, and our friend Cowboy got on me a little bit on our page months back. I said, if I had a choice between Dustin Pedroia and Robinson Cano, I know Cano's the better player, but I would take Pedroia. As a manager, I could watch him play for 6-7 months and be like, that's how you play the game.
Yeah.
You know, but Cano is an otherworldly talent.
Pedroia has more rings, obviously.
Right.
But I agree. As a manager, it would frustrate me. And it would frustrate me even more because I knew I had no power over it. It's not like high school. In high school, you get your superstar player, and you would have the ability to be like, you're going to sit down or whatever. You're the manager of the Yankees. What are you going to do with Robinson Cano? There's no way you could really do anything with discipline. And, you know, I don't know. I agree with you in that point. But I'm just looking back at this point in my life. I'm a fan, and I'm like, look, we can't just chastise Robinson Cano for his flaw, which is one flaw is not hustling. Everybody's got flaws. And I know it's something that's a mental, or like, it's something you could always do. You could always hustle. You're not going to change it. So this is who Robinson Cano is. You're going to take the good with the bad. Just like Manny's crazy antics, I'll take Manny Ramirez on my team in the 2000s any day of the week. So that's where we differ.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to go into great detail. I mean, I've battled injuries and a lot of different things. Can't run like I could years ago without discomfort. And I know at the core of a lot of my issues, especially with baseball, that's present there. Every time I watch the game, I like to see guys play it the way I believe in my mind I would. Now, if I was in the big leagues and I was good as Cano, would I jog sometimes to protect myself and make myself more money on my walk here? Probably. I think that's just the way the game, it's gone that way, and now it's continuing to head further that way. So, yeah, I mean, I understand there's a little bit of hypocrisy there, but when I turn on a game, I like to see guys playing as hard as they can. That's just me. I never sat here and said, you and Neil should feel this way, otherwise you're a moron. I just said, when I watch, that's what bothers me with Starlin Castro. Like,
I didn't say you were a moron.
What's that?
I didn't say you were a moron.
No. I said, I'm not trying. It bothers me when I watch it. And so hearing that discussion, to put a bow, hopefully, God willing, on this discussion.
We just went 35 minutes.
Yeah, I think Flaherty said the way I've been thinking all these years. Instead of just killing Kano for not running at all, I just want him to run a little bit. Make it look professional. You're getting paid to play ball, which I don't know.
And hard enough where you don't get hurt.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. He doesn't have to bust it every single time. I keep going back to Pete Rose. He doesn't have to be Pete Rose. Pete was a different kind of guy. But just make it look professional.
He's a scumbag. That's what he is.
Well, I mean, that's fine. But, I hope that's the end of that discussion.
All right, Neil, we wrapped it up pretty good, huh? How is your duty in Sirius doing?
It was a nice, tight session. I'm really proud of us all.
We gave the fans a little bonus time today. I like that.
Who did Neil agree with at the end of everything?
Neil just likes
something was offensive. I heard the word offensive, but I don't know if
he's Canadian. Switzerland, dude. He's
my theory.
If you were to, like, say it was debate team, Neil, you have to give a win to me or Dan. Who you got?
I just think, Dan, I respect you and I love the hell out of you, but I think it's just a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, my friend. It's one player who just is at ease and peace with being, substandard, subpar, and he could be great. I think, and to Mike's point, like, okay, Yankees fans might have driven him away, but I don't know. I just don't see that either. So it's a draw.
Thanks a lot to William Poulter for giving us a sound of the fury.
I just thought he was Switzerland, man. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening to the show. I'm to bigger and better things next week. We're going to try to see sports guys for Mike DePalma, Dan Santarella, and Neil Lynch. We'll be back next week. Check us out, as always, tristatesportsguys.com, facebook.com/tristatesportsguys, or @tristate_sports, as Danny gives his NHL tweets during the playoffs. It should be good. We'll see you next week. Have a good night.